You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Lee Camp. Lee Camp is the head writer and host of the national TV show Redacted Tonight with Lee Camp on RT America. He is a former contributor to The Onion, former staff humor writer for Huffington Post, and his web series Moment of Clarity has been viewed by millions. He's toured the country and the world with his fierce brand of stand-up comedy. George Carlin's daughter Kelly said he's one of the few comics keeping her father's torch alive. Bill Hicks' brother Steve said Lee is one of only a handful with Bill's message and passion. And like all good people, Lee Camp is from Charlottesville, Virginia. Lee Camp, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. That was a very kind intro. Slight correction on where I'm from, actually. Well, mainly D.C. and Richmond, but I went to UVA. I'm well-cultured in Charlottesville.
Yes, I was aware. I think that counts, being from UVA. We could talk about the flaws of UVA, but not its basketball team. So, Lee, I understand that you are now the governor of Idaho. How's that going?
Yeah, I just anointed myself governor of Idaho because I learned from Donald Trump and his crew that apparently you can just announce new leaders to areas of the world and they don't need to be elected or even really have much support, as he's done in Venezuela with Juan Guaido, who apparently polls show that before our government announced he was the new president of Venezuela, 80% of the country had never heard of him. So apparently you can do that now.
So you might actually have I don't know what percentage of this country has heard of you, but you might have better standing, a more legitimate basis for declaring yourself governor of part of the United States.
Yeah, and I mean, right now I think the governor of Idaho is a hedgehog wearing a bow tie, so I don't think many people will notice. But, you know, this attempted coup that's going on right now, U.S.-backed, is I think it's more blatant than I've seen in a while. I mean, this is, you know, with Nicaragua, at least they kind of tried to do it behind the scenes a few months ago. Now this is just straight front and center. And they also are kind of barely even keeping a pretense as to why they're doing it, the U.S. and our allies. You know, John Bolton said on Fox News that it was basically for the oil and that getting the oil would be very important to the American people. So, you know, even the false reasons they give about helping Venezuelans or caring for democracy, even those seem to be falling by the wayside in a manner that I think we've rarely seen.
It's hard for me to figure out how you manage to make fun of these people when there's almost nothing left to make fun of. They're quite openly committing blatant crimes, nothing hidden. How do you mock that?
Yeah, it can be hard sometimes. I said years ago that I thought reality had lapped satire. I mean, it just is getting so ridiculous. But you know, this last Redacted Tonight, I covered some of the history of Juan Guaido, and I also mocked CNN's coverage of the Venezuelan attempted coup, because they had this insane propaganda piece where it's, you know, they have a reporter down there and he says this is supposed to be a socialist utopia, yet every belly is empty, everyone is starving. And they then cut to an image of the pro Guaido protesters who are clearly very well fed, because they are mainly the rather wealthy in Venezuela. And, you know, it was so laughable. But so I make a lot of fun of the media. I think that's one of the best ways to go. You know, and for those of us who will, like, see through this attempted coup, it also is really showing you where the lines are drawn on our mainstream media. I mean, it seems to me there is no one on our mainstream media that is even questioning this U.S.-backed coup, from MSNBC to CNN to Fox News to NPR. It's they act like it's all justified and it's going to go great, as the U.S. has proven in many times, countless times, that when we get involved in countries, you know, everything just goes great afterwards. We really just bring the people up and they're just all happy, and then we leave their society alone.
Yeah, Honduras is working out so well. I don't see what Venezuelans have to be upset about.
Honduras and Iraq and Syria and Libya.
I think it's a great answer that you mock the media that's misreporting the story. But I'm struck by the fact that when one of these stories totally conflicts with one of their other stories, they either just go silent or lie. I mean, I've heard that the coup in Venezuela is a great favor to Vladimir Putin, despite the fact that, of course, it's exactly not what Vladimir Putin wants. How do they keep all these stories straight when they blatantly conflict?
You bring up a great point. It's completely this whole, Russia controls Donald Trump and they rig the election, you know, the neo-McCarthyism and everything. That's all kind of falling on its face when you try and say, oh, but also Vladimir Putin and Russia supports Maduro, and they, you know, they call Maduro a dictator and he supports Maduro. And it's like, well, wait a second. I thought you just said that Trump is Putin's pawn and everything Trump says is in favor of Russia, and yet here you are with Russia backing Maduro and Trump and all of the neoliberals, all of the faux MIC resistance people. They're all supporting this U.S.-backed coup. I mean, basically the entirety of Congress. And it's like, well, that doesn't fit with your whole Putin's puppet scenario, does it? And we, you know, a week ago or 2 weeks ago, a clip went viral of Bill Maher twisting himself in a pretzel trying to explain how this proves that Donald Trump is Putin's puppet, but also this is, Venezuela, Putin wants to keep Maduro in power, and so they're the ones against the coup. It completely falls on its face, it's amazing to watch. It's amazing to watch them fall all over themselves to try and force this to make sense.
I don't know if you've put together a whole list of all the things Trump has done as Putin's puppet, but it seems like, you know, he's against banning weapons in space or cyber war. He tore up the Iran agreement. He's against Russian energy deals, going
more
after sanctions. Venezuela.
Sanctions. More sanctions than under Obama, right?
Sanctions on Russia, weapons into Ukraine. NATO members have to invest more money in weapons, expanding NATO. And yet you still have this story, not just on the news, but now after all these many months, in everybody's head, you know, in conversations and emails and social media, everybody's got this story.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I think that's why it's called manufacturing of consent. It's amazing that if you get enough of a drumbeat going and you just don't let up, you know, like they have not let up for basically 2 years of, you know, trying to drip out this narrative. And it's amazing to see it really impact almost everybody. I mean, I have people, friends and things that are big fans of my show, Redacted Tonight, and they see the reality of our media and everything, and yet they still go, well, yeah, but Trump has been pretty good to Russia. And I'm like, are you looking around? Are you looking at any of the facts? Like, Obama, you could have said Obama was great to Russia because he didn't have nearly the number of sanctions that Trump's administration has had on Russia. It's amazing that this type of manufacturing consent really does work. And, you know, as we started off with, now they're doing it with Venezuela, trying to manufacture the consent for the American people to back this, and how could this end? This could end in civil war in Venezuela if they succeed, thousands and thousands could die, and that seems to be fine with them. And, you know, it's a real inconvenient fact that, like I said, Juan Guaido has such little support in Venezuela, but on top of that, he went to graduate courses in George Washington University and studied under Beres Batia, who was the former executive director of the IMF. And so you've got like an IMF, created kid who also is basically funded through various ways by the U.S. regime change labs that we have. And, you know, here he is just declaring himself the president and we, I guess, have forced a bunch of other countries to also say, oh, he's the president. And it's also been interesting to see these digital platforms that now control the narrative, control our truth in this world. Like Wikipedia, immediately when he announced that he was president, switched him to president on Wikipedia. And then there were 37 edits going back and forth with people trying to switch it back to Maduro. And then eventually Wikipedia locked it as Guaido, as president. And now it says they're both president and says disputed next to it. But, you know, Wikipedia and these platforms, they control the truth of our world.
They do, and I've never been able to correct that so-called truth. You're absolutely right. They flip it back immediately to what they're claiming. We're speaking with Lee Camp, who is the head writer and host of the national TV show Redacted Tonight with Lee Camp on RT America. Lee, I have the exact same experience with people who are on email lists for groups like World Beyond War that are supposedly dedicated to ending all war. We say something against NATO, and they say, oh, but wait a minute. NATO is the force for good to protect us from the evil Russians. We're planning a no to NATO, a yes to peace festival in D.C. in April that you've been good enough to say you'll come and speak at. And people can go to notonato.org and sign up and come or find out about it. Have you noticed that that being against NATO is now equated somehow in everybody's mind with being for Trump and Putin and global disaster?
Yeah, and first of all, I'm very excited to speak at that. So thank you for inviting me, and I think it'll be a great time to show support for an actual peaceful world. Using many of your own great quotes, I covered this NATO and everything a couple of episodes ago on Redacted Tonight, and I think you're absolutely right. They've convinced people that NATO is this force for peace in the world, but if you look at the record, really it's just this banner that we, you know, put on our wars to justify blowing things up and destroying societies and killing countless people. And we, you know, put the NATO logo on the top, and all of a sudden they say, "Oh, well, these are the good kind of bombs." Well, no, they're not. I think I said on the show, it's the Christmas wreath on the front door of the murderer's house, so that everyone looks at it and goes, "Oh, that must be a nice guy." Well, no, look at the bodies in the basement. I mean, and my favorite quote of yours was when people say this is the only way for countries to show their cooperation. You know, there are non-belligerent, non-warlike ways of cooperating with other nations.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like people have never heard of treaties or bodies of law or courts or the United Nations or the International Criminal Court. It's like if either you're in NATO and you're a good team player at bombing people or you're an isolationist. Like, there's no other way to engage with the world than NATO.
Right.
It's crazy to me. People think this, right? And they don't want – how do we get them, you know, mocking the stupidity of the stuff they think with us together without having them think we're making fun of them? You know, this is what I struggle with.
Yeah, well, I think part of it is – and this has probably been one of the big successes of the past 10 years, is like showing people some of the cracks in the narrative. It's not as easy to pull off a coup attempt like they're doing right now with Venezuela as it used to be. I think, a little bit of truth goes a long way. So even though there's only a few reporters, American reporters, covering the truth in Venezuela, it gets out there pretty fast, and it makes things at least fairly difficult for the war powers. And so I think it's kind of like you get people to doubt a little bit, and then hopefully they'll eventually figure it all out and keep moving towards peace. So I agree. It's a tough argument to have. You just walk in and say, NATO is a war entity. They tend to refute that, but if you say to them, you know, but look at this and look at this and look at what happened in Libya, and, you know, start questioning the narrative, then things can unravel.
Yeah. They imported a leader for Libya from the D.C. metropolitan area, as I recall, just as many years back in South Korea. I mean, these, and I guess there's one in waiting for Iran still.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these D.C. bred leaders of other people's countries haven't tended to work out very well, as far as I can tell.
And that's another, you know, I talk about John Bolton saying we're basically doing this for oil. Another thing that's pretty out in the open is Juan Guaido has said his goal is to privatize open up the countries and the country of Venezuela and the resources to U.S. influence and corporations. So, you know, he's kind of outwardly said, I'm going to, like, sell off our resources to these corporations and it's going to be so wonderful. And, you know, hopefully people can understand that's not a good thing for the Venezuelan people.
Apparently a lot of people in Venezuela understand that and others don't. It may be a question of where their income comes from. But did you see, Lee Camp, this recent story from NBC News about the fact that the Russian government and its propaganda machinery is taking a great interest in Tulsi Gabbard?
Yes, how hilarious is that? Basically, anything that the mainstream is worried about, or really the oligarchy, the corporate rulers are worried about, they just say, oh, Russia supports it. So the latest one that's making them nervous is Tulsi Gabbard, because she is the only candidate, as far as I can tell, and this includes Bernie Sanders, that's really, you know, out and out against the war machine and says it on a regular basis. And talks about the military-industrial complex and talks about our U.S.-backed coups in other countries. And so she makes them very nervous. So just this week, it was Russia's backing Tulsi Gabbard. And where do they get that information? How do they support that? Well, they point to New Knowledge, which is this fraud of an organization that was outed by the New York Times, no less, a few weeks ago, of having created a false flag in the Roy Moore election campaign in Alabama. Now, Roy Moore is a disgusting human being. He was that accused pedophile that ran for office down there. But the New Knowledge outwardly said that they created a false flag, basically. They made it look like a bunch of Russian bots were following Roy Moore, and then they leaked to the press, hey, look at all these Russian bots following Roy Moore. And the press ran with it. I mean, you can go look at the articles now, Mother Jones and others saying Russia is supporting Roy Moore. And it's now clear, and they actually internally, they bragged about it. Look at what we did. And so it's now clear that that was all fake. But, A, you don't hear corrections from these media outlets saying, oh, you know, 2 months ago we brought you completely fake news. Sorry about that. And, B, these media outlets, NBC, is now pointing to that exact organization and saying, they told us that Russia supports Tulsi Gabbard.
Yeah, I mean, and even if it weren't a story based on a fraudulent outfit exposed in the mainstream U.S. corporate media as a fraud, I mean, wouldn't the news be? Wouldn't the actual news story be if Russia didn't take an interest in a U.S. presidential candidate who appears less likely than some of the other ones to want to nuke Russia? how could Russia not take an interest in her? And wouldn't it really be the news story if they failed to? I don't get it.
Well, maybe, but I assume most Americans would get upset about the whole idea of a bot army that is tricking them into thinking, you know, a certain candidate has a lot of followers, but of course, most of this bot army crap has been proven false. You know, the other place they always point to prove these the Russian bots are doing such and such is Hamilton 68, which has been just completely, it's this organization or tool that has been completely debunked as proving just about anything. Even the co-founder was quoted as saying, well, yeah, many of these Russian bots may not be Russian and may not be bots and may be real human beings. And so you're like, well, then that's not a Russian bot. You've just disproven the entire thing that Hamilton 68 is supposed to do.
But the this most recent story from NBC News, but going back over the past couple of years, including the so-called intelligence reports, a lot of it is not about the robots on Facebook. It's about, you know, RT America television and, you know, media outlets, as if there's something secret and nefarious about press stories that are, you know, by definition, public, you know. I mean,
well, yeah. I mean, it really comes across like they just can't understand someone who wants peace and wants equality. Like, that worldview is so foreign to kind of the ruling powers that if they see that, you know, such as someone like you or me or even Tulsi Gabbard, they say, oh, that can't be genuine. That must be some sort of nefarious foreign government.
Right. Who would be for peace on Earth unless they'd been, you know, bribed into it? I feel like I should mention that that Marianne Williamson, who's not a member of Congress but is running for president as a Democrat, is better on peace, as far as I can tell, than any of them. But Tulsi.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
But Tulsi Gabbard is certainly better than most of them. Although that's, you know, that's pretty low bar. Can I ask you about other stories in the news? Because I want to get your your take. I'm mostly offended by the fact that they interrupted the UVA basketball game for this, but this press conference by the governor of Virginia, right, declaring that after he had examined and studied and thought about it for a day, he decided it was safe to claim that he wasn't this guy with blackface in this racist photo from decades gone by. Now, How is that sufficient in his mind? I mean, if he had to think about it and study and decide whether it was him, then he had some reason to think it might have been him, right? I don't get it.
Well, yeah, and I mean, he clearly is guilty of something, and you know, I mean, yes, what he did is incredibly offensive, and he should likely step down, but I also think that, you know, whenever I see these stories, I'm like, oh, of course, these lawmakers, most of them, these politicians are, you know, liars by trade. And so they're going to lie to try and defend themselves. And it kind of doesn't really surprise me. But, you know, what's interesting is I remember, and, you know, that photo was supposed to be in 1984, I think.
Yep.
But he said in his speech that he's not sure he's in the photo, but he does know that he put on blackface to perform as Michael Jackson in a talent show.
Yeah.
And I actually remember I was at UVA. I was a judge on a talent show because I was a comedian. And so this is the year is like 2000, maybe 2000 or 2001 or something. And one of the groups does a Michael Jackson song in blackface. And the other judges give the group the top score because they did a good job of singing, I guess, and dancing.
Yeah.
And I then gave him a low score because I said, I'm not really okay with the blackface. And the entire crowd of UVA students booed me.
Oh, my God. And this was, what, you say about 16, 17 years later than the photo of the governor. Wow. I think you did the right thing, and I will applaud you now long after the fact, because, there has to be some standards, and the notion that the governor sort of, pushed in his press conference that, well, this was back in the 80s when it was okay to be a racist. they're going to use that somebody if one of your, you know, friends in that thing from the year 2000 gets into politics, you know, they're going to say, well, this was okay back in the year 2000. When was it ever okay?
Yeah, I don't know that was ever okay. I do know that growing up in Richmond and everything, the Confederate flag was definitely viewed as, you know, by a lot of white people as fine. And my high school had it as a logo when I first joined the high school, and then they slowly removed it over the next 4 years. But it was definitely very commonplace. And, you know, you see a photo of that, and it doesn't age well.
It doesn't. No, it doesn't. Nor do our statues here in Charlottesville.
Yeah.
We were gonna talk about the biggest elephant in the room and have saved it for last, I guess. But the Pentagon has been getting more and more money and figuring out where less and less of it went. How have you been covering this?
Yeah, it's $21 trillion of unaccounted for adjustments, and you know there's a lot of debate as to what adjustments are. But it clearly, whatever we end up finding out, it is very clear that they are not keeping track of the money at all. And it's just kind of flowing in and flowing out. And they are never told they can't afford something or can't afford to do some bombing or some, destruction overseas. And they just failed a few months ago, the first audit in the Pentagon's history, even though they've been legally mandated to do it since 96, I believe. And it's like this is one of the biggest stories in the nation. I mean, it should be. And instead, it is completely not mentioned, completely blacked out from our mainstream media. And, you know, I wrote an article on Truthdig about it that went kind of viral. And I think it's because, like, people are hungry for this truth and this reality. But it's like, with the exception of you know, you and me and a few others, David DeGraw did some great work on it, but it's been this kind of quiet thing, and I think it is starting to come out. You know, Ocasio-Cortez tweeted about the $21 trillion, and people are beginning to ask questions, and I think it's making some of the ruling elite a little nervous.
That's got to be a good thing. We've got just about a minute left, Lee Camp. Don't you think that when people ask, and by people I mean corporate media, ask, where are you going to get the money for education? Where are you going to get the money for healthcare? Where are you going to get the money for good things? The answer doesn't always have to be, well, we're going to create public banks or we're going to raise taxes, but mostly only on the rich people, and here's the details. But the answer could once in a while be, I'm going to cut 4% of military spending. Why wouldn't that be a better answer politically as well as morally and practically?
Yeah, absolutely. A drop in the bucket of our military spending could do so much for our nation and for our world. I mean, the estimates by the UN were that $30 billion a year would end world hunger, and that is nothing to compare to our military budget. We could end world hunger and be the safest country in the world, because no one wants to attack the country that ended world hunger.
It would give us
security, but it's totally ridiculous that they say we don't have the money. And in fact, many people point to this as proof that whenever they say we don't have money for healthcare, we don't have money for infrastructure, it's just a blatant lie. Because of the amount of money we have for military, this we don't have money thing is just a game they play, and they never say it about military. When we were going to invade Iraq, did anyone say, oh, but it's going to cost too much?
Very few of us, and I wish we could go on. We've been speaking with Lee Camp. You got to catch him on his show, Redacted Tonight, and at the No to NATO events. Go to notonato.org. Lee, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks so much. I'm at leecamp.com. People can find it all.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, U.S. elite media have heralded Saudi Arabia's crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, as a reformer, young and brash, as the New York Times editorial board had it, who is uplifting women in particular in the monarchy. It takes a lot to upset a narrative, particularly from a country that's mainly only reported in terms of its strategic partnership with, i.e. usefulness to, powerful U.S. interests. But one would hope that reports that Saudi Arabia, under MBS, as he's called, is torturing women political prisoners would be sufficient. We'll talk about story versus reality with journalist Sarah Aziza. Also on the show, former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz doesn't like the word billionaire. He'd prefer we speak of people of means. Thank you. Schultz is responding, touchily, to the increased willingness to engage seriously proposals to reduce wealth and income inequality in the U.S. We'll talk about some of those proposals, what they can and can't do, and why we need them all, with economist Dean Baker, co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and author of the free book, Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. That's coming up this week on Counterspin, and we're going to get straight to it. When Saudi Arabia officially lifted a ban on women driving last June, it made for a great photo op. Time magazine had a video feature in which they rode along with the country's first women taxi drivers. 60 Minutes had already declared Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman a liberator of women. For the New York Times editorial board, the young and brash leader is in some ways just what his country needs, because he would allow concerts and would consider reforming laws tightly controlling the lives of women. But U.S. media are only slowly coming to acknowledge that beyond the photo op lies a very different reality. Journalist Sarah Aziza writes on these issues, among others, for The Intercept, as well as other outlets. She joins us now by phone from Brooklyn. Welcome to Counterspin, Sarah Aziza.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you actually saw reporters swarming on the photo op of Saudi women driving, and one can see why. It's both a symbolic and a material change that seems to say that Saudi Arabia, under the influence particularly of Mohammed bin Salman, is on the road to reform. But subsequent and even previous events should tell us that that's not really the story here. What should we know about bin Salman as liberator of Saudi women?
Yeah, I would say that it is not the full story. It is true that there are some women, particularly who come from liberal families, middle or upper class families, who are enjoying the benefits of these, you know, limited reforms, the increased flexibility for women in the workforce and the ability to drive. It's no small thing, symbolically or practically. But on the much grander scale, Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, is we often see him referred to in the press, has ushered in an era of really unprecedented crackdowns and repression of all forms of political speech, but also just a general chill of authoritarianism that's rendered even ordinary citizens afraid to speak about the royal family, to discuss their opinions whatsoever when it comes to the reforms that are happening in their society or even everyday topics, whether it's issues of culture or commerce. There's just this sense that, yes, there are movie theaters and concert halls. People are enjoying attending, but no one there feels the freedom to speak openly about anything anymore. On the issue of women in particular, it's perhaps the most monstrous paradox of MBS's reign so far is the way that he's branded himself as a liberator of women. He's defended to the foreign press that women in Saudi Arabia are equal, absolutely equal, and that he is just here to empower and raise them up. And in particular, in relation to the women driving, that's the most perhaps egregious and awful irony was that practically all the women who had campaigned for the right to drive, some of them dedicating decades of their life to peaceful protest and demonstration and petitioning of the government to obtain the right to drive, among other rights, they were all in jail when the day finally came, when all of the reporters were swarming these open lots, these choreographed spectacles that looked so good on the front pages of newspapers with these smiling women. But in the meantime, the women that really had the legacy of pushing for these reforms were in detention. They have not yet faced trial or even formal charges, not yet had access to legal counsel, haven't seen their family. And we've had recent reports in the past few months that several of them at least have faced systemic torture and sexual abuse while in detention, at the same time that MBS was using their cause as evidence of his credentials as a reformer.
Well, when you wrote about this in 2018, you said that one activist said that maybe the crackdown has something to do with the regime not wanting the lifting of the ban to be seen as a reward for that activism. They'd prefer it be presented as a gift from the king.
Absolutely. That's been one of the themes of Bin Salman's reign, is this absolute top-down, unilateral approach that any rights or privileges granted to his subjects must be seen as coming directly from him and a product of his will and his will alone. And that there are no channels, there's no two-way channel between the people and the government, that they are not to have expectations of activism or organizing as bringing about any changes or demands. This is not a conversation. This is a patriarchal top-down granting or bequeathing of rights as he sees fit. So the locking up of these women journalists was a way, we think, of preempting any sort of credit-taking or any sort of celebration. The women were contacted ahead of time in some cases and told not to even tweet congratulations or in praise of the reforms, because that could be seen as attaching themselves to the outcome, and MBS wanted to fully control the narrative for himself.
Well, and then to go back for a moment to the women in prison and the reports of abuse, including torture, this is something new, this mistreatment, right, of women. This is not common exactly.
No, absolutely not. The concept of female political prisoners was pretty unheard of before MBS. And that comes back to, in a lot of ways, the sense of propriety, the patriarchal norms that in many ways, you know, harm women so much, but in another sense have these really stringent and old-fashioned ideas of modesty, where women are not meant to be publicly displayed in any way. But that really has fallen by the wayside in the case of many of these women activists. They were viciously attacked in the pro-government press. There was a smear campaign. They were identified as enemies of the state. Rumors of their connections to foreign governments, to Qatar, among other things, were just splashed across the front pages of local newspapers, along with their pictures, which is, again, just such a transgression of modesty norms in the country. So it really just shows a willingness to transgress all normal bounds by MBS in order to push his narrative forward at whatever cost and victimizing whomever along the way.
The October 2018 disappearing and presumed murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Turkey was absolutely shocking. And yet the murder itself sort of got swallowed up in debate over how Trump or the U.S. should or would respond to it. What did you make of the treatment of Khashoggi's killing? What got lost, do you think, there in media coverage?
I think that what got lost the most perhaps are the long-term implications of allowing MBS to really, in an essence, get away with murder. You know, this is a young man who, although there are elements to his reign that may still be tenuous, he's really consolidated an unprecedented amount of power. and, you know, maneuvered his way into the crown prince position. His father is very old and ailing, and should this man, you know, succeed to the throne, we could be dealing with a Saudi Arabia led by MBS for 50 years to come, for decades, and it's an absolute monarchy at this point still. So the implications for millions of Saudis and for the world, as well as just the freedom of press in general and the violation of just the concept of journalism and dissent, all of these universal principles, presumably universal principles, seem to be just swept aside in favor of Trump and Jared Kushner's personal relationship with the Crown Prince and an unwillingness to perhaps endanger a lucrative arms deal or strategic interests against Iran. So it's a really short-sighted approach that was taken to Khashoggi's death, and it's really a travesty of justice and a tragedy for all those who knew him and for what he represents as a journalist and as a Saudi.
Well, let me ask you about, and you talked about this, but within Saudi Arabia, and, you know, outside of Thomas Friedman chatting with a cab driver, we don't hear much street-level storytelling, really. You reported that many Saudis are themselves unaware of the government's crackdown on activists. Like, it's not necessarily something that everyone is talking about or maybe comfortable talking about.
No, there's certainly a sense of confusion. There's a lot of obliviousness. Definitely, apart from the smear campaign against Loujain Al-Hathloul and some of the other women's rights activists back in the summer of 2018, a lot of these arrests and disappearances they're emerging through Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International reports and social media, but they're going unmentioned in the local press. So there's a lot of confusion, a lot of lack of awareness. And then when there is awareness, there's an incredible reluctance to even admit knowing anything about these subjects. Everyone's worried that even having an interest, even following stories that are critical of MBS could render them liable to be called enemies of the state themselves, could be targeted for arrest or stigmatization or suspicion under this growing sense of a police state and thought police in a way. And you see that even the impact on social media, people shutting down their accounts, being unwilling, even their anonymous accounts, to be on Twitter or Facebook anymore, to even click on stories that they think might lead somewhere to a critical story. And I should just add that Saudi Arabia has been expanding and emphasizing their anti-cyber crime laws that really criminalize any use of media or propagating any information that might be seen as portraying the kingdom or the royal family in a negative light. So these are now criminal offenses, and everyone's just tiptoeing as far as their information and conversation surrounding any of these issues now.
It's amazing in a way that activism continues under these circumstances. Well, finally, I mean, outside of the false hope, if you will, that MBS is being portrayed as, where do you see real hope within Saudi Arabia?
Well, I speak to a lot of people both inside and outside the country, and there seems to be a pretty unanimous opinion that the hope really lies outside of the borders of Saudi Arabia at this point, whether it's Saudis abroad who are advocating for their people, or it's journalists and activists, human rights groups, and foreign governments who, it's really incumbent upon them to look at the evidence and admit what's so obviously there, that this is a dangerous leader, that he's taking Saudi Arabia into a really frightening direction, and that there needs to be meaningful sanctions and consequences for him now rather than later. Each time we let him get away with another violation or offense is another reinforcement in his mind that he has an impunity that renders him exempt from the rules. So, yeah, I was speaking to even one leading human rights activist from Saudi Arabia who's in exile now, self-exile, and she told me, my only hope is in the international community. Yet she does have hope. She says, I believe in my people and I believe in our women. They've overcome so much for decades, so they won't be stopped, but it's absolutely incumbent upon the rest of us to do our part too.
We've been speaking with Sarah Aziza. You can find her recent piece, Mohammed bin Salman is Running Saudi Arabia Like a Man Who Got Away with Murder, on TheIntercept.com, and a related piece, The Saudi Government's Global Campaign to Silence Its Critics, on NewYorker.com. More of her works at SarahAziza.com. Sarah Aziza, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed this.
One in three GoFundMe campaigns in this country are for medical expenses. One in five households have zero or negative wealth. Millions of people are one paycheck away from hardship. And this is the same society in which there are people who can't remember how many houses they own or are puzzled about why furloughed federal workers would be going to food banks. Inequality is a life or death issue, which makes it especially disconcerting that some folks with media megaphones seem proudly ignorant of the basic mechanisms by which resources are distributed. Some myths and misunderstandings are being thrown into relief as we're seeing a strikingly bold, for recent times, conversation about progressive taxation, occasioned by proposals from New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, among others. But if the present debate goes further than we're used to, does it go far enough? Dean Baker is co-founder and senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He joins us now by phone from Utah. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dean Baker.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Well, corporate media have trouble or often don't bother to distinguish between ideas and those espousing them. So when Ocasio-Cortez suggests the idea of a top marginal tax rate of 70%, that gets sucked into the vortex of her coverage, you know, coverage of her, as with wealth tax proposals from Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. Before we talk about the limits of those ideas, I wonder if you could just talk a bit about both top marginal tax rates and increased taxes on extreme wealth, given that media often present those ideas as kind of ideas from Mars or proof that these politicians are wild-eyed fantasists.
Yeah, well, the reaction to both proposals has been fascinating, both the public reaction where there's clearly been a lot of support. People are saying, yeah, you have a lot of real rich people. Why shouldn't they pay more in taxes? But more so from the media and, you know, from some establishment politicians. So the reaction is, oh, here's flaky Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, where she'd get off 70%. And in fact, that's a number that many of the world's most prominent tax economists have said. This is the maximum tax rate. Maximum tax rate in the sense maximum amount of revenue. And there was a article, widely read article by Peter Diamond, who's a professor at MIT, and Manuel Saez, who's at Berkeley, both very, very prominent. Diamond won Nobel Prize, Saez, John Bates Clark Award, two of the most prestigious awards you can get in the profession. So these are people in very high standing. And they came up with that number, you know, and there were all sorts of qualifications and reservations. But in any case, they didn't think it was ridiculous. So when you have a new member of Congress propose that, well, the media jumped on that like, oh, she's just being flaky. And in fact, it's a very reasonable thing to put on the table, whether that's the right rate. You know, of course, you could debate that. But it certainly was not a ridiculous proposal. And, you know, again, Paul Krugman had a very nice piece where he's contrasting that with the Republican proposals to cut taxes on the rich, where they were saying that they would pay for themselves, which was ridiculous. But that was treated like these are serious people. So it's been fascinating that there's been such a rush to dismiss these as kind of far-out proposals by radical leftists when they're reasonable proposals, which, again, is not to say that they're necessarily the best policy, but they're certainly reasonable proposals to put on the table and to be debated.
Well, we read that Michael Dell, who has $30 billion or so at the World Economic Forum, apparently said, name a country where that's worked ever, the 70% top marginal rate. Missing something, you could say.
Yeah, of course, one of his co-panelists said the United States, because that was, in fact, the rate in the United States until Ronald Reagan lowered it with his tax cuts in 1981. And if we go back a little further, it was 90% in the Eisenhower days. Kennedy lowered it to 70%. So, again, one could argue whether these are the best rates, but to treat this as a crazy idea out of, you know, far left field is just wrong. And, you know, some of the back and forth, because I was on Twitter with Dell and, you know, there were others involved, obviously. And what I find most striking here, Dell's kind of a poster child here, because what is Dell's expertise in this area? He's very rich, no doubt about that, but he obviously knows nothing about tax rates. I mean, again, we could disagree 70% the right rate, But to act like that's just impossible, we're going to see our economy collapse, that's nuts. He knows nothing about it. He just has $30 billion, so therefore he thinks he's qualified to talk about it.
Well, it's good, I think, that we're talking about taxing extremely high incomes and wealth for all kinds of reasons. The LA Times' Michael Hiltzik was saying, you know, it helps move us away from this notion that wealth is self-made, you know, that these folks owe nothing to society, and it disrupts the fallacy of trickle-down. But having said that, it does take the form of a give back. You know, you've got an absurd amount of money, so you should throw some back in the pot because that's the socially decent thing to do. You suggest in this recent piece for Truth Out that while that is not wrong, it's not getting to the crux, the bigger source of the rise in inequality.
Yeah. So the point I made in that piece, and really I've made in much of my writings over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years, is that the distribution of income is not something that just happens. It depends on how we structure the economy. And I would say the economy is pretty much infinitely malleable. We could structure it all sorts of different ways. And my favorite example here, just because it's so blatant, is I like to say, how rich would Bill Gates be if he didn't have copyright or patent monopolies on Windows software? So if anyone in the world could just start producing, mass producing computers and copy in Windows and all the other Microsoft software, and they don't even have to send him a thank you note. Well, needless to say, he would not be one of the richest people in the world. He wouldn't have $100 billion. I'm sure he'd do fine. But, you know, the fact that someone like Bill Gates could become incredibly wealthy was because of how we designed that market. And it's pretty much the same story everywhere you look. Finance, where would all these Goldman Sachs guys be if we didn't have the bailout in 08 and we just let the market run its course? I mean, there's many other ways we subsidize finance as well. Corporate CEOs, they were always well paid. But if you go back to the pay standards of the 60s and 70s, they'd be getting $2 or $3 million a year, not $30 and $40 million. So we structure rules that allow people to get incredibly wealthy. And I really prefer that to be the focus, both because as a practical matter, it's much harder to get the money back once they have it. I mean, there's all sorts of practical issues that people have rightly raised. You know, when Elizabeth Warren says, let's tax the wealth, well, they're not just going to hand it over to you. It's going to be hard to do. It doesn't say it's not something we might want to do, but it's going to be hard. And secondly, the political issue. If we act as though, well, you know, Bill Gates got that fair and square, we shouldn't take any of it back. If you go, well, we could have kind of structured it differently, and then Bill Gates won't have it, and then we don't even have to have this discussion.
I wonder, do you think it's a trap to talk about these things in terms of revenue, in terms of how much money it would bring to the economy? I read a piece by Vanessa Williamson from Brookings where she said that taxes on the very wealthy should be judged by their societal impact and not simply by their revenues, that it has to do with the fact that just having some people be so wildly wealthy is incompatible with democracy. And so we shouldn't get too hung up on how much money it would give to the economy to institute some of these changes. What do you make of that?
I think it's a very important point. And I remember some years ago, there was a piece on the estate tax that was done by Alicia Minnell, who's now at Boston College. And she came up with some figure that we get a relatively small amount of revenue, you know, from the estate tax. And I'm saying relatively small. It's still substantial, but much less than if you just said, oh, here's how many rich people died and we tax it at a 40% rate. Here's what we get a very small amount relative to that. But she wasn't writing as a critic of the tax, because the two points she was making, one is exactly this one. The part of the story is we don't want massive amounts of wealth to be handed down so you get Donald Trump or his kid, you know, walking away with billions and suddenly having all this political influence. But the other is, part of what they do to avoid the tax is do things like start foundations, like the Ford Foundation and the Gates Foundation. Now, those aren't my dreams. I mean, there's a lot of bad things I could say about the way those foundations are run. But the point is, that's not altogether a loss for society, because they do some good things. So to act like, oh, they aren't going to pay the tax, they're just going to start a foundation that provides inoculations to children in Africa, well, that's not a bad thing. So to just look at it and say, okay, how much revenue are we getting from the tax? That is missing the point.
Well, and then, though, going back to Michael Dell, he said, you know, my wife and I set up a foundation and we would have contributed quite a bit more than a 70% tax rate on my annual income. And I feel much more comfortable with our ability as a private donation to allocate those funds than I do giving them to the government.
Well, I guess I'd have to tell the Michael Dell he still could do that.
Exactly. But I think what people are saying is the problem isn't whether that's true in real numbers. The problem is running a society on noblesse oblige, you know.
Yeah, no, we don't want to have to depend on, you know, I wasn't going to go into my criticisms of the Gates Foundation, the others, but yeah, we don't want to depend on their goodwill. I mean, people need health care, they need education, you know, all the other necessities of life, and it shouldn't depend on whether Michael Dell's, he and his wife are good people and they're going to contribute to that. I mean, it's nice if they want to, but that shouldn't be what we depend on.
Well, a poll from that Pinko Rag Business Insider showed that Ocasio-Cortez's proposal, the 70% top marginal tax rate, was more popular than the GOP tax cuts, which you alluded to before. People don't even think that socialism is a curse word anymore, which removes a real arrow from some folks' quiver. But I think we want to say that none of these proposals working on pre-tax income, post-tax income, they're not opponents of one another as proposals, right? And other things like raising the minimum wage could fit in there too. I guess it just does seem like more ideas are on the table than we've grown accustomed to. And I wonder how we keep that window open and how we keep pushing for more.
Well, it has been great that, you know, you have people put it on the table and there's been a good popular response. And I have to say, to some extent, our best allies in this have been the Republicans, the conservatives, because they've said things that are just so absurd. I mean, I remember Scott Walker, the former governor of Wisconsin, was criticizing Ocasio-Cortez's 70% proposal, and he's talking to fifth graders, and he says, so you do some work for your grandmother, and she gives you $10, and the government takes $7 of it. And he goes, and they all go, that's not fair. Of course, it has nothing to do with her proposal. She's talking about people who get over $10 million, so over $10 million. And so I don't know whether Scott Walker literally doesn't understand a marginal tax rate or he's just being dishonest about it, but he publicized this, and needless to say, he got raked over the coals for it. My guess is he won't do that again. But it has certainly pushed the window on how we could talk about these things. So in that sense, we don't all have to agree that A, B, or C is the best, or, you know, what I would say is we probably want a mix of A, B, and C. But in any case, it certainly expanded the window of discussion in a really positive way.
We've been speaking with Dean Baker. He is senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. They're online at CEPR.net, and that's where you can also get hold of Dean's free book called Rigged. His piece, Progressive Taxes Only Go So Far, Pre-Tax Income is the Problem, can be found at truthout.org. Dean Baker, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks, Janine. Good to be on again.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
We are witnessing the end of the age of ice on Earth. I'm pretty sure about it. It sounds great, doesn't it? Especially during blustery February. We'll cancel the celebrations. Sea level rise is going to be wicked this century, and for centuries after that, we will redraw the maps if we have maps. We will withdraw from ports, we will lose the weather we need for agriculture, and maybe regroup into little tribes that will survive somewhere. It's news that good. And new revelations from climate science are coming in so fast, no single scientist or radio host can hope to keep track of it all. It is like standing in front of a fire hose. In this program, we're going to surf some of the highlights with our favorite climate generalist, Paul Beckwith. Paul has a master's degree and an engineering degree. He taught climate science at two Canadian universities. Now he is, without a doubt, the world's biggest climate teacher on YouTube, with over 500 videos full of charts, satellite images, and plain explanations about the bizarre unfolding of climate change. We're going to cover the whole wild world, from the South Pole through Australia to Europe, North America, all the way to the North Pole. From Ottawa, Canada, Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's a pleasure to be on the program.
People like to talk about the weather, Paul. How has the weather been in eastern Canada lately?
Well, I call it weather whiplashing or weather wilding or weather weirding, whichever term you prefer. You know, we go from very, very cold weather, almost record low temperatures. You know, we're there for, you know, a week or so, and then we swing up to above freezing temperatures for a few days, and then we switch back down to very, very cold temperatures. And this cycle seems to repeat all of the time. Of course, it's very, very hard on infrastructure because those thawing cycles, you know, melt the snow and ice, which then goes into the cracks and roads, et cetera. These transitions to warm and to cold are extremely fast. They often happen with temperatures changing even a couple degrees per hour, you know, whether it's going up or down. And this is very, very hard on infrastructure.
Yeah, I saw a weather forecaster on TV in the States talking about a 70-degree Fahrenheit switch, 21 degrees C within 24 hours. And yes, it is hard on infrastructure, but it's really toxic to plants. I worry we will see tree die off and lost perennials from those sub-zero chills followed by spring-like warmth the next day. I guess we'll find out.
Yes, it's very, very hard on the plants. It's very hard on animals as well. They're confused about what's happening. You know, some of them might think spring's on the way, and like a lot of them aren't surviving, especially with some of the temperatures in the southern hemisphere. There's lots of animals that just aren't surviving these temperature swings and these extreme temperatures. So, you know, we're comfortable in our houses, hopefully, although I did read that a huge number of homeless people perished in these latest chilling temperatures in the U.S., although the numbers aren't all in on that. But, I mean, they didn't have a place to go. They very likely did not survive.
We hardly ever hear about that. Every time I see the forecasts about the super cold, then they talk about the trouble it's going to be for airlines and commuters, and you wouldn't know that there's more than 500,000 homeless people on the streets in America, and they're getting hit pretty hard. I wait for the person to talk about it, and they never do. Well, look, when we think about global warming, we do imagine the hot days, way too hot days, and fires, which we've been through. And we are going to get to that later on in the show. But I think right now it's time to talk about what I call the winter of climate change. And do we have some clues, Paul, about what the new winter is going to be like?
We've talked numerous times about the jet stream and how the jet stream is changing, how it's slowing down and becoming wavier. So this outbreak of cold air, you know, which has been coined the dividing or splitting or collapsing of the polar vortex, which brought a huge mass of very cold, dry air over the U.S. deep to the south. I mean, with the jet stream waviness and pieces actually breaking off of these waves, which are extending very far south and as far north as the North Pole, this is just the world that we're living in right now. I mean, the Arctic is still darkening at very fast rates. We're rapidly losing sea ice and snow cover. So the temperature is all wonky up there, if you like. It's much warmer than it should be. So the temperature gradient to the equator is lower. So we're getting these jet streams and becoming so distorted and wavy. You know, it's hard to call them even a jet stream anymore. It's just a fractured mishmash of high velocity air up at the border between the stratosphere and the troposphere. So one of the things we'll talk about maybe in a bit is James Hansen's most recent paper called Global Temperature in 2018 and Beyond. I'll do a bit, at least a video or two on this in the next few days. But basically, they're showing that this really cold temperature over North America is just over North America. I mean, if you look at some of the maps, they show this cold area, you know, over North America, and the rest of the planet is much warmer than normal. So, yeah, winters are definitely heading out, but there's lots of these surprises as we transition through abrupt climate change from what the stable world that we had before to where we're heading.
And if there is global warming, people from California mountains to upper New York State to Britain and Moscow are all asking after their big dumps, why are we digging out from so much darn snow?
Yes, and we do know that, you know, in a world that's generally warming, there's more water vapor in the atmosphere. So when we have seasonal changes, the oceans have warmed so much that, you know, as the season changes and we move through fall into winter, the land cools down and, you know, we have the very warm oceans that are producing huge amounts of moisture that's going over the land, causing massive snow dumps. So there's lots of regional effects that are coming into play, but it's very important to remember the big picture of the greatly warming Arctic has just messed up the circulation patterns in the atmosphere and ocean, and we're really suffering the consequences of this right now.
Yeah, in Germany, Eastern Europe, and there was a snowfall in Moscow that they hadn't seen the like of which for 70 years. And scientists are now saying, well, look, the Baltic Sea is abnormally warm, and that's lofting more moisture into the air. And that's going to be like an extreme precipitation event, but if it's winter, that comes down as snow. So global warming can create more snow, and that drives some trolls crazy.
Yes, it does, absolutely. And if you think about the jet streams, getting back to them again, I mean, they dominate the climate system, and they dominate the weather patterns. But when they're so weak and broken up and distorted, then one has to ask, what is the new effects that dominate, you know, weather patterns? And basically what it is the land-sea contrast. And I've done a number of videos on this. You know, if you Google Arctic monsoon, basically what the monsoon effect is, you know, in the summer, like the land always heats up or cools down faster than the ocean because water retains heat and releases it slower. So it has a much higher heat capacity than soil or air or anything else. So the land, in the summer, the land will heat up much faster than the ocean. So because the land is hotter, the hot air over the land will rise up, creating a low pressure area, like a partial vacuum, if you like, and that sucks air from surrounding water bodies, and that air is laden with moisture. Okay, so then that moisture comes across and it rises up and we get all of these storms. So in the winter, of course, the land is cooling down much faster than the oceans. Okay, so the breezes that come off the ocean will then give dumps of snow. So these effects are being seen around the planet, actually. They're much more regional effects. So we're going into this monsoon-type world, and a monsoon just dumps huge amounts of water on the land. So if it's in the summer, it's going to be rainfall, and, you know, we're talking about inches of rain per hour and leading to massive floods, torrential rains. And then in the winters, the precipitation, of course, is, you know, because of weather whiplashing, it could be dumps of snow, it could be dumps of freezing rain, it could be, and both. I mean, we had actually in southern Ontario, we had some thunderstorms looking to develop a few days ago when the temperatures were, you know, reached well above zero. In fact, Toronto a few days ago was plus 12 degrees Celsius, if you can believe that. It set a high temperature record a few days ago, whereas a few days previous to that, it was setting low temperature records of wind chills, you know, minus 35, minus 40 almost wind chills. Like, and it goes from one to the other and then back. And this is completely bizarre behavior, but it seems to be what is happening in our new climate world.
Well, even the lakes are getting warmer, and we have new science out on that. I'm looking for an interview with an assistant professor at the University of Toronto who just published on, quote, widespread loss of lake ice around the northern hemisphere in a warming world, end quote. And that will affect snow downwind from those lakes. But I wonder what else. I mean, ecological systems, species loss, invasive species. We have some science about the loss of sea ice and what it does, but I wonder about the loss of lake ice.
Yes. You know, a lot of northern lakes, the ice is not forming. It's forming later. It's not forming as thickly. It's melting earlier. It's having a huge disruption of all of those freshwater ecosystems. These effects are most significant, of course, in northern lakes, because remember that temperature change from climate change is, you know, much, much faster in the polar regions. As you go closer to the pole, you get much more rapid changes in temperature. If the temperature, you know, at the equator, the temperature is rising enough, but it's mostly the humidity that's rising, because the higher temperatures there lead to more evaporation, more humidity. And of course, that when you combine the humidity and the temperature reach that, you know, the horrendous 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb temperature, then those areas can become kind of uninhabitable. I mean, this is a huge question that I'm always asked, you know, where are we going to head next with the jet streams? So I did a number of videos on the idea that the center of cold is shifting in the Arctic. So as we move to a blue ocean event, so the standard state with ice in the Arctic Ocean, ice on Greenland, you know, if you take the centroid of that cold, if you like, the weighted center of all that coldness, it's not right at the North Pole. It would be if Greenland wasn't up there, but it's shifted a bit towards Greenland, offset from the North Pole in the normal state. But now, you know, when we go to a no sea ice, you know, which would happen first in September, maybe, you know, maybe in the next 4 or 5 years, it's still looking, or even 3 years, 2022 perhaps, who knows exactly, but it's going to happen. The trends are saying it's going to happen. Then the center of cold will shift. The extreme is if there's no sea ice year round, then the center of cold will be the center of Greenland, which is at 83 degrees north latitude. So that would represent a shift of the center of action of jet streams of almost 17 degrees. So the jet stream would shift down towards Greenland, which would make North America probably the coldest spot, the coldest holdout left on the planet. And we're seeing some of that. So I'm wondering if some of this is coming into play already. And then, of course, you have to consider that the air movement, like when the Arctic Ocean's covered in ice, it acts as a continental climate in a way. So cold air over Siberia will come directly across the ice, and the ice acts as like a land surface. I mean, there's no water, there's no significant open water to affect the air movement. But when the Arctic is completely open and there's no sea ice, apart from the rapid warming and the loss of, because of latent heat effects causing huge warming, that energy isn't changing phase anymore from ice to liquid. It's just heating the liquid. Then that will completely modify these patterns. So the patterns that we see will be completely rewritten on the planet for that period of time. And, of course, that has huge implications, not just in the northern hemisphere, but in the southern hemisphere as well.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is Paul Beckwith, climate scientist from Ottawa, Canada. We're talking through the latest shocking science news about rapid climate change. If you want to follow up on any story, you can get the links to everything we talk about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. There's new science out, and I'm going to take a couple of minutes just to read from this press release because it's pretty shocking. It says, melting ice sheets may cause climate chaos, according to new modeling, and current international climate policies do not take into full account the effects on the global climate. I have an interview request into the lead author in New Zealand, and I want to take this time just to read from this press release from McGill University in Canada, because this is going to impact a lot of listeners. Warming in eastern Canada and cooling in northwestern Europe. The ice sheet simulation suggests the fastest increase in the rise of sea levels is likely to occur between 2065 and 2075. Now, a lot of you are going to be alive then. Melting ice sheets will affect water temperatures and circulation patterns in the world's oceans, which will in turn affect air temperatures in a complex ice-ocean-atmosphere feedback loop. And they say water levels will not simply rise like in a bathtub. Some areas in the world, such as island nations in the Pacific, would experience a large rise in sea level. While close to the ice sheets, the sea level would actually fall. However, they continue, the effects of ice sheet melt are far more widespread than simply leading to changes in sea levels. As warmer melt enters the oceans, for example, in the North Atlantic Ocean, major ocean currents, such as the Gulf Stream, will be significantly weakened. This will lead to warmer temperatures in the high Arctic, eastern Canada, and Central America, and cooler temperatures over northwestern Europe on the other side of the Atlantic. So they're talking, you know, 50 years or so from now, there could be a real speed up, an increase in the rise of sea levels, and big changes to the weather in large parts of North America and Europe. So your comments, Paul?
Yes, we must have one of these Vulcan mine melts going on, Alex, because that paper, I've skimmed through that paper it just came out, and it's also going to be, dissected in a video. But yes, near the ice sheets, the sea level will actually drop because the ice sheets have enormous gravitational attraction of waters. You know, Greenland actually pulls the oceans closer towards it because of all that massive ice on Greenland. So as the ice sheets rapidly melt and lose mass, you know, over 250 gigatons, billion tons per year each, you know, Antarctica, Greenland, then there's less water pulled towards them. So the sea level can actually locally decrease in those regions. And this is also was a big puzzle. And there's also the phenomena of isostatic rebound, where when the ice leaves the land surface, that immense weight, 3 kilometers of ice would push the land down a kilometer in the steady state. So when that ice melts back, the land will rise up. So it's rapidly rising up in large parts of the northern regions just from this effect too. So you have all of these other effects going on, and I'm sure they're accounting for them in this ice melt paper that you've just been quoting. You know, also there was a recent paper, on the Thwaites Glacier in West Antarctica, and a huge hole was found inside the glacier. This hole was etched out by warm, salty ocean water, the glacier sitting on bedrock well below sea level. And this cavern or huge cavity in the glacier, it was actually measured to be 4 kilometers long by 10 kilometers wide by about 1,000 feet or 300 meters high. And the water, the ice that melted in that was about 14 gigatons of ice. And that's just one feature in one glacier, you know, and they happened to be looking in that region and spotted it with their ice penetrating radar and also their satellite radars measuring the distance from the satellite to the surface of the ice. So they could see changes. So at the surface of the ice, it decreased in height. So the ice is melting, you know, decreasing in height, but it's mostly melting from below in Antarctica.
Yeah, that story, for some reason, is one of those that just freaked me out because I just covered with Eric Rigneau 2 weeks ago the story that Antarctica is losing 6 times more ice mass annually now than 40 years ago. Now, that's as shocking as it gets. But then to feel that the ice is disappearing deep underneath that whole of Antarctica. You know, we can look down from space and we see this big white blob, and it's always used to be represented in climate models as a slab. But now we know that a lot of Antarctica is actually deep underwater, perhaps pushed there by the weight of the ice. And the warmer oceans are just soaking up under there. We don't know how many caverns like that there are, how many tunnels where the warm water is just undercutting the glaciers. We could see some big changes in Antarctica that may surprise us.
Yes, you know, also East Antarctica, the same sort of thing. We thought it was quite stable because most of it is, of that ice, is grounded on bedrock that is above sea level, whereas West Antarctica has vast regions that are of ice that are grounded at well below sea level. We're talking about over a mile below sea level, like 7,000 feet in some regions where the ice is sitting on the bottom, 7,000 feet below existing sea level. So, of course, as the ice melts from the bottom, the surface will drop and the ice will eventually start floating. And then, you know, of course, the tides have a huge influence in bringing the water in and taking the water out on a daily cycle, washing the warm, salty water in, and then the melt water will be cold, fresher water, and that will be washed out, and it repeats the process. So as long as these nonlinear, highly nonlinear processes happen, then the rate of ice loss, mass loss from Greenland and Antarctica seems to be doubling about every 7 years or so. So if you take, and this has happened for at least the last three doubling periods, 20 years or so, and if you continue that doubling period, we're talking about huge sea level rises. You know, I've done a couple of videos. I said, can the sea level rise 7 meters by 2070? And that's actually, you know, if you just do back of the envelope calculations of the doubling period, then we get enormous sea level rises, nothing like what is the IPCC and other people are talking. But, you know, as long as we get surprises in how fast the ice is melting that keep up the nonlinear doubling period, which is exponential decline, then that's what the basic back of the envelope calculations give you, which is would be horrendous for society, of course, you know, coastal cities. I mean, look at the effect of society when a couple buildings come down. Now consider all the buildings in major cities along the coastlines having to be abandoned. I mean, the economic implications are staggering.
Yes, indeed. And here's another example of that exponential rise. It's a paper that came out January 21st. The title is Greenland Ice Melting Four Times Faster Than in 2003, Study Finds. And it says southwest part of the island could be a major contributor to sea level rise. Lead author Michael Bevis from Ohio State University says, quote, in the case of Greenland, global warming has brought summertime temperatures in a significant portion of Greenland close to the melting point, and the North Atlantic Oscillation has provided that extra push that caused large areas of ice to melt. So there's another case, you know, faster four times than 2003. That's just recent history.
Yeah. Well, this is exactly, it fits right on what I'm talking about with a seven-year doubling period. So, you know, if you have a melt rate in 2003 of X and it's 2X 7 years later, and 7 years after that, it's 2 times 2X, which is 4X, which is 4. So that fits with that seven-year doubling period. And also the problem is that we're in the meltwater from these glaciers is high concentrations of methane they're finding. There's organic material underneath the ice on the surface layers of, above the bedrock and stuff, organic matter, and that's decomposing with the warm, salty water coming in, and then that's producing methane because it's anoxic. There's little oxygen down there, and that methane gets dissolved in the water column, which is in the runoff that comes out. You know, the water leaving the bottom of the glacier is high in this, has saturated in methane as well. So this is another big factor. Also, those lakes that you're talking about in the northern regions that are not freezing so long, they're thawing earlier. And they're also, a lot of these are producing huge amounts of methane. And there's new lakes appearing because of the areas of unfrozen ground, the talix and the permafrost, as it thaws out. If there was a lot of water content in it, then it will collapse. And you'll get a crater, if you like, and a lake appearing there. And then those lakes are producing huge amounts of methane. So, you know, not a very good situation, to say the least.
Well, I said at the start, you know, this is the end of the age of ice, and we go from Greenland to the Himalayas. I know you know a lot about this. I just want to read briefly from a new report called the Hindu Kush Himalaya Assessment. It's an open access book online. I'll put a link to it in my show blog at ecoshock.org. But what they say in summary is that the scientists found that if nations drastically cut greenhouse gas emissions and keep global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, the Hindu Kush Himalaya range will lose one-third of its ice by 2100. Well, we can kiss that goodbye because as we're going to talk about a little later, there are predictions already that we'll hit 1.5 degrees in the 2020s. But then they say a temperature rise of 2 degrees C would lead to 50% of the ice being lost, and a global temperature increase of 4 to 5 degrees would melt two-thirds of the region's glaciers. They've already lost 15% of its ice since the 1970s. This is just a disaster for India, for Pakistan, for China, for Tibet. All of these places are getting huge amounts of water and hydroelectricity, crop irrigation from that ice in the Himalayas, and it's going, and will be gone, I think.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, so there's less snow, you know, in these high-altitude regions, and the snow up in these mountain regions is like a battery, if you like. It's like a storage. I mean, that when it starts to melt in the spring, it releases water, which feeds all these rivers. So the problem is with climate change, there's less snow falling in these regions, so the storage is much slower. The melting in the spring is much, much faster. So instead of getting a steady stream of water in the spring, you get this massive deluge of water, you know, over a period of a few weeks, causing huge flooding damages along these rivers. And then these rivers dry up and there's very little water source in the summers. And this affects, you know, so there's drought and no water supply. And this affects, you know, 1.9 billion people, I believe the paper said.
Well, here's one, Paul, as we just cover these melting ice regions that maybe you've heard about, maybe you haven't. I was shocked to learn about it just last night. And it's about extreme temperature. This was posted February 5th, 2019, that the southernmost parts of Chile and Argentina hit 90 degrees Fahrenheit. And this is just crazy stuff. They had to close schools and government buildings because they're not designed to cope with temperatures, anything like that. There's a local beach, and I put that in quotes, which is generally the cold front facing Antarctica. It's populated by penguins, if anything. And suddenly there are stunned humans down there. It's pretty cold to go in, but it's just that hot, and they haven't seen it. And another person comments to that post. They say, I've been to Argentina and the Chilean Patagonia, 38 degrees C at the southern icefield glaciers like Parita Morena, Viedma, Uppsala and Gray is incredibly scary. The South Icefield Glaciers is the third largest reservoir of ice on the planet after Antarctica and Greenland. I didn't know that, and now it's in danger.
Yes, Australia is getting nailed. We've all heard of that, right? The temperature is up to 50 degrees, and also this has actually come to South America, as you say. When those type of temperatures hit people, like in Australia, you know, they're used to hot temperatures, but not that hot and not for such a long period of time. So they have air conditioning, but they've had lots of brownouts and power failures because the demand on the power grid for the air conditioning has just been too severe. But in places in South America where countries aren't as wealthy and also this is completely new to them, these type of temperatures. So they don't have air conditioning. They can't, you know, they can't get out of the heat. You know, these heat waves are killer, sort of like the silent killer, if you like. You know, the key thing is that the temperature is not dropping at night, right? It's not. It stays very, very warm at night. It doesn't allow the human body to recover from all the stresses of the heat during the day. And then it's a cumulative thing. And, you know, very young people, very old people are much more susceptible. They're nowhere near as physically resilient to withstand these sort of processes. So, yes, most of the physical changes to the ice, of course, are in the northern hemisphere that we talk about, the greatly warming Arctic. But we're seeing significant changes to the sea ice that forms off Antarctica. It used to grow about 1.5% per decade, and we've had record lows recently. And there's also clear indications that the ocean currents around Antarctica have been changing. And Hansen, in a few papers, has talked about the warm, salty, deep water that can penetrate further under the ice in Antarctica, you know, to greatly increase the melt and that sort of thing. So because the Arctic is much darker than it used to be, it's absorbing more energy, so it's warmer. We've got this Arctic temperature amplification. So because the temperature gradient is lower between the equator and the Arctic warming by itself directly as a darker place, then more of that heat from the equator is going to the southern hemisphere. And this is what's happening in South America. This is what's happening in Australia. There's more heat being carried into the southern hemisphere. The southern hemisphere is not a bug-out haven for people who want to avoid the worst of climate change. I'm sorry, it just doesn't work.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest has become the largest single climate science teacher on the internet with over 500 videos on YouTube, and they are great videos. I watch them. Paul Beckwith joins us again from Ottawa, Canada. Well, New Zealand has just been hacked with hot weather. It's been way too hot for people in the capital of Wellington, and few people have air conditioners there. And the seas around New Zealand, the Tasman Sea, has been way, way too hot. And I would like to add that the island of Tasmania is under a heat wave. And under
wildfire.
Wildfires, yes.
Yeah. There's a new phenomenon down there. It's so hot and dry, there's huge evaporation. Of course, the vegetation is very stressed. And then we're getting these thunderstorms now where it's so hot and dry on the ground that the rainfall evaporates before it hits the ground. So you still get all the lightning. So it's dry lightning. So all of these lightning strikes are occurring on the very dry forest, causing these massive wildfires. Like, it's not wet surface, right? Lightning can always hit a wet surface and not cause the fires. But this dry lightning phenomena is there in Tasmania now. That's a big deal.
And they had world-class, world-protected forests that hadn't burned for thousands of years that burned a couple of years ago. So they're feeling the terror of the wildfires that we feel here in British Columbia and people in California and all across Western North America. And I want to get over, too, to something that we have just touched on, and that is the ocean warming. And I was looking at New Science, but this was actually back in 2016, so I guess I won't call it New Science, but it says industrial era global ocean heat uptake doubles in recent decades. Peter Gleckler was the lead author of that. But here's what interests me. It says, our model-based analysis suggests that nearly half of industrial era increases in global heating of the oceans have occurred in recent decades. So it's just the last few decades are really smacking into the oceans. Is that your perception as well?
You know, if you look at any metric on climate change, really, you know, it's the last few decades. Human emissions in the last few decades have equaled what we'd put in the atmosphere in the previous 100 years sort of thing, right? So we're on the tips of these exponential curves going up, and that, you know, that's true whether, you know, look at emissions or ocean heat or even the temperature rise, which is covered quite a bit in James Hansen's February 4th paper, Global Temperature in 2018 and Beyond. He talks about some things like that.
Well, talk to us about that paper. I'm really interested.
Yes, all the details I'll put in a separate video. But basically, from 1970 to 2018, we've had a rise of 0.17 degrees Celsius per decade. And, of course, we had these super El Niños in 2015 and 2016 and also in 1998, you know, which caused spikes. Of course, he talks about the last 4 years, including 2018, being the warmest. 2016 was the warmest. Now, he shows images of maps of where the warming is occurring, how it's distributed. And 2016, the warmest year, was a degree Celsius warmer than the 1951 to 1980 mean. Now, they used that mean when they did the map because they had lots of data then. But then if you compare it to the 1880 to 1920 mean or average, you need to add 0.27 degrees. Now, if you compare the 1880 to 1800 time frame, you need to add about another 0.1 degree, and from 1800 back to 1750, another 0.1 degree at least, and even from 1880 to 1920, the temperature rose about 0.1. So you have to add 0.2 or 0.3 degrees. So if you add that to 2016, relative to 1750, we were at between 1.47 and 1.57 degrees Celsius rise in temperature. Of course, this is significant because Paris is all about 1.5 aspiration. right? So Hansen also talks about how quickly the land temperatures are rising relative to the ocean temperatures. So, you know, I've already said the global average temperature has risen since 1970, 0.17 degrees Celsius per year. Now, if you separate that into land and ocean, the ocean's risen surface has risen about 0.1 degrees Celsius per year, and the land temperatures has risen at almost three times the rate. We all live on the land, at least at the moment, so unless you're in a nuclear submarine for a few years, closest you are living on in the ocean, it would be a small island in the middle of the ocean somewhere. But anyway, these numbers are actually broken down in great detail in this paper. What I really also like about the paper is the chance of an El Nino appearing is about, it was mentioned as being 70%, you know, back in December. You know, maybe it's about 65% chance of happening this year, but it probably wouldn't be as strong as the previous El Nino. Also, there's some really interesting data on solar irradiance and sunspots. And, you know, yes, we are going into a solar minimum, right? In the next 2 years, we might reach the minimum of sunspots. But the variation of solar intensity is only 0.10%. So it's a very, very small fraction. It does have an impact. One of the things that contributed to the strong El Nino in 2015 and 2016 is we were near the peak of the solar cycle, right? So that would have added that small percentage increase. It would have contributed to that strong El Nino, but the effect is completely overwhelmed, really, by greenhouse gases. So all of these things are in this recent paper.
Yeah, I'll put a link up to that. And NASA also put out a press release saying that the five hottest years in the record are the last 5 years. And I'll put that up in my blog.
Yes, that's the Goddard Institute of Space Studies, which is NASA talking about this data, which is in the Hansen paper. And Gavin Smid is also on that paper, the Hansen paper. He does the reports for GIST, Goddard Institute of Space Studies.
Then we have the Met Office in Britain saying that the world is heading for its warmest decade. That's their prediction. Well, that isn't too hard a prediction to make considering what we've been talking about. But it does say that in the next 5 years, there's also a chance we will see a year in which the average global temperature rise could be greater than 1.5 degrees C. Not 1.5 in a single year, but greater than that 1.5 above pre-industrial that we talked about. So they're saying that before 2025, let's say, there's a good chance that at least 1 year will already be above what Paris Climate Agreement set out as their hoped-for target.
The aspirational 1.5, yes. I wonder if they mentioned in that article that, yeah, we actually already crossed 1.5. And the year 2016 was 1.47 to 1.57 above the 1750 pre-industrial temperature because of the strong El Nino. So what the Met Office is saying is that, this will happen in a non-El Nino year. It won't get that additional bump from heat being released from the oceans, which happens in El Ninos.
And, of course, the same story was covered by Britain's Daily Mail newspaper, and I had the honor of going back and reading the comments down below the article, and I got things like this: all rubbish. Multiple volcanoes are going off all over the world as we speak. That's more greenhouse than we can create in a lifetime. It's all lies, folks, says one commenter. And the next one says, just out of interest, where are the grants coming from that makes scientists so wealthy that they're happy to lie about their findings, end quote. But, you know, maybe those are real posts from very poorly informed people, or maybe they're just Russian bots out there trying to stir us up and keep the fossil fuels coming from Russia to Europe. Who knows?
Yeah, I know. That's the problem, you know, with this information. And we talked at the beginning of our interview about this cold spot over North America. And the best illustration of this is figure 4 of the Hansen paper, which you'll post a link to. It breaks it down by season, the temperatures. It gives a map of the world, and it shows the regions that are colder and warmer than normal relative to the 1950 to 51 to 1980 average. And the September, October, November map, there's a blue area, a cold area covering North America. Every other part of the planet is red and brown, you know, much warmer than normal. And, you know, that pattern has obviously continued December, January, February of 2019 as well.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. Paul Beckwith, Canadian climate scientist, is my guest. You've been talking about something that really interests me, which is kind of negative feedbacks. I mean, we have in the natural world a lot of different cycles going on with the oceans, in the atmosphere, and even including our position in space, as we learned from a guest a couple of weeks ago on Radio EcoShock. The tilt towards the sun matters. You brought up sunspots. But I think the key thing is that those negative feedbacks or negative cycles may have held us back and made it seem cooler than we actually are. But that means we're in for a shock when they go back the other way and they start pushing even hotter. So what are your comments on that, Paul?
There is, of course, short-term fluctuation, but it's really the trends that are key. I really want to bring people back to a paper in 2017. And it's anybody can access it. It's open source. It's Creative Commons. It's by a whole bunch of authors. It's called Young People's Burden, Requirement of Negative CO2 Emissions. You know, Hansen's the lead author. It talks about why we absolutely have to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. That's the idea of negative CO2 emissions. But in the paper, it talks about the changes from the different forcings of the gases. So if you average the forcing, how much energy is there, power is there, watts per square meter at the surface of the Earth on average from all of the different gases that we put in the atmosphere? CO2, of course, is a big one. It's 2.1 watts per square meter. I'm talking about figure 4 in this paper. Methane is 0.8. CFC 0.4, nitrous oxide 0.2, ozone 0.2. So you add those up and you get 3.7 watts per square meter. Per square meter, that's an average forcing on the surface of the Earth from these additional burden of greenhouse gases in 1750 that we put in. And the aerosols are minus 1.2, and that's a 3.7 minus 1.2 is that 2.5 number. Right, which is like 2.5 watts per square meter. It's like one of those little Christmas light bulbs, you know, on every square meter of the Earth. That's the forcing that's causing all of our problems. But the aerosol is a big component. So the aerosols, you know, as we phase out coal and things like that, you know, this global dimming effect will decrease and decrease, so the warming will accelerate. So this is why, you know, I'm saying that we absolutely have to look at solar radiation management techniques to compensate for this. You know, it's all pretty clear what we need to do, and I'm really hoping that the push by progressives in the U.S. for this, the new Green Deal, groups like Extinction Resistance and Solar Sunrise, you know, these different groups, more and more cities are calling climate emergencies. I think Vancouver was one of the ones recently. You know, what does this mean when a city calls a climate emergency? It means that they have to greatly increase the rate at which their climate action to reduce emissions is, for the most part, that's what they're looking at. But the new Green Deal is all about completely, you know, on a World War II scale effort, completely retooling the U.S. to renewables by the year 2030, which is only in 12 years, which is that time frame. You know, we've got 12 years left to do stuff, which, you know, would be a whole new show to talk about whether that's valid or not. 12 years, I mean, where does that number come from, 12 years, right?
Well, you know, 10 years ago, people said we only had 10 years.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, that's a pretty amorphous figure. But I know that the climate mobilization launched a city-by-city strategy after Donald Trump got elected because they figured, well, it's just not going to happen in Washington. Maybe with the Democrats, there's new hope. But we have seen declarations, as you said, from Vancouver, Canada, Hayward, California, and in the United Kingdom, Cornwall and Lambeth, and then just out on the news that Halifax has also declared Halifax, Canada, a climate emergency. But I have to say, they're not always the greatest declarations. Vancouver said they wanted to be fossil-free by 2050. Well, as you've just said, if it isn't by 2030, it's not really going to help us much. The ice we just talked about will be all over, and there will be global ruin, I would say. You raised another topic that I've been working hard on, which is the aerosols, basically the smog or the pollution, the global dimming, call it what you want. I did interview Yang Yang Shu a couple of weeks ago, who found that over China, even though they're cutting back on their emissions with some success, they will still get more smog there because of regional conditions that develop due to climate change. So climate change is actually going to make the smog a little more easy to form and a little more available. And there's a new paper out just published February 4th, 2019, called Enhanced Land-Sea Warming Contrast Elevates Aerosol Pollution in a Warmer World. And so they're saying that they have confidence that a warmer world will be associated with more aerosol pollution. So in a way, we're going to be cutting back and trying to clean up because people need to breathe. People are dying of pollution. But even as we do it, the climate itself is going to make the pollution that's left sort of more available and more there. And we thought it was going to get rained out. And I asked Yang Yang Shu about that. And he said, well, you get extreme precipitation events. Yes, they do clear out the air. But then you have following dry periods that are longer. And during that time, the smog forms. So they don't think, neither one of these papers thinks that the increased rainfall is going to help us really clean the air enough.
Where the rain is falling is obviously changing. So we're getting, as you say, torrential rainfalls, and you know that will completely clear out the aerosols in a particular region. But a light rain would clear out the aerosols, right? So all that extra rain in the same area is not getting extra aerosols. They've already been rained out in the first part of the rainfall. Whereas, you know, areas that are under drought and, you know, where there's lots of loss of moisture of water from the soils and from the vegetation and stuff, then, of course, those regions will be dustier. And then it depends on the wind patterns as well as to how much of those, you know, aerosols are lofted up, particles are lofted up and become aerosols from the ground, for example.
Well, my sense, Paul, looking at all this, is that a combination of climate pressure, some small, some large, could push us up a step in heating. And in fact, we've just had the hottest 5 years ever. You spent a few years investigating abrupt climate change, and scientific studies have shown that that has happened in the past. Do you think it's happening now? Are we just on a new step on the on-ramp?
Yes, I would always call it abrupt climate change. And, you know, lately, you know, sometimes I say rapid climate change or very rapid climate change, but you know, abrupt is sort of a term a bit loosely defined because you have to find, you know, abrupt with respect to what time scale. Definitely people think in a linear fashion, right? They think, okay, temperature rise. I mean, I actually talked. I said that on average, we're getting 0.17 degrees Celsius increase per decade since 1970. Now, if you look at just the last few years, right, it's much, much more than 0.17. Like the last decade, you know, has not been 0.17. The last decade has been much, much higher than that temperature rise. So it's always a moving target when you have nonlinear change. This is why all these papers and all this science work on climate change has to say this is much faster than expected, because a lot of the models and stuff, they kind of work on this premise that things are going to change in a sort of linear fashion. And that's clearly not how the real world works. So we really have to get a handle on that. And when we do get a handle on it, we recognize, hey, we're in a climate change emergency. You know, we're going through abrupt change. And this is why you can't think when something happens 1 year, you can't expect that the same thing will happen the next year. For example, you know, a local example for me is I had friends that live on the Ottawa River that were flooded out during the record rainfall a couple of years ago. And they were all paranoid. They were all scared stiff that the following year would flood them out again. And the following year was a bust as far as rainfall was concerned. The Mississippi River will go from record flooding 1 year to record low levels the next year, you know, interrupting shipping abilities, barge traffic, to record flooding even the third year, even worse than the first year. And this is this climate whiplashing, weather whiplashing or wilding, right? It's from boom to bust cycles. It's huge variability. The variability of our climate and weather systems has shot off the charts.
You've suggested, Paul, and you've been saying this for years, that we should spray some aerosols over the Arctic and try and save what's left of the Arctic sea ice because it has such a huge effect on the climate of the rest of the world. I'm trying to picture that. For one thing, you know, it makes me very nervous as an environmentalist while we're trying to clean up the smog in one part of the world. We're going to add what is essentially pollution in another part of the world. Do you think that will just slow down the loss of sea ice? Could we actually try and cool the whole planet? Is there any chance of going backwards towards the climate that humans evolved in? What are your thoughts?
It's vital that we slash fossil fuel emissions, right? It's vital, but that's only one part of it. It's also vital that we pull CO2 out of the atmosphere so that, as well as slashing, you know, what we put in the atmosphere, we deploy methods, whether it's using biomimicry. I think the oceans are the key. But we reduce CO2 levels. I mean, a healthy climate is CO2 levels that were about the 300 level, right? There's a group 350 now that says 350. We have got to get back down to there. Healthy Climate Alliance is saying 300. You know, is this possible? I mean, if you don't have a goal, then it's certainly not possible. You know, you have to set a goal first and try to get there. But, you know, this stuff's all too slow. We lose Arctic sea ice in a few years. Greenland's exposed and vulnerable. You know, rates are going to skyrocket there. You know, we lose the air conditioning of the Arctic. Temperatures there skyrocket. Our jet streams are completely refigured. So, you know, if there's any possible way to cool the Arctic, then yes. And we know when a large volcano goes off and puts sulfur dioxide up in the atmosphere, it cools the planet. It can be half a degree or a degree for 3 years. Right. And we know it's the sulfur dioxide in the volcanic, that the element, the molecule that comes out, which does the cooling. So if we do an artificial, you know, we put that stuff up artificially in the upper atmosphere, we can cool the planet. We know the physics works on that. Now, the thing is that this is an emergency type situation. Right. Where, you know, we're losing our food supply or something on the planet. The climate takes out multiple sources of food on the planet. People are starving to death. It's an emergency. People are dying in droves. You know, we could deploy this and cool the planet. Right. Now, the thing is, you know, do we leave it that late? Like, it's much better than, there's things that are much better than sulfur. Like iron salt aerosols is a very interesting technology. There's a 54-page paper that came out a couple of years ago, and I'm still reading it, trying to understand it. It's not easy reading, but the idea is that during previous glaciations, there'd be drying of deserts, and then particles would come up, and they would add iron to the oceans, which would stimulate phytoplankton blooms, which would draw vast amounts of CO2 out of the atmosphere. So the idea of these iron salt aerosols are to create aerosols with iron content that can increase the amount of iron going into the ocean on a widespread basis. And we're talking about micro levels, not putting huge amounts in, that will stimulate phytoplankton and draw out carbon from the atmosphere. These also are aerosols, so they provide the aerosol cooling over the oceans, right, to cool the oceans. So these things can be... It's like both techniques. It's like carbon dioxide removal, and it's like solar radiation management. It's all with one technology. And the concentrations are so small, you know, it's not quite as innocuous as marine cloud brightening, which is just pumping seawater through nozzles, and then the salt particles from the seawater that go into the air, if they're the certain size, they create very small water vapor condenses, creating very, very small droplets, which then have a lot of reflective capability to brighten the clouds, the marine clouds, to reflect solar energy, right, to reduce the warming. So this is a technique that Stephen Salter has been working on for years. There are some technologies like this that are becoming very promising. There's a company called Blue Planet that is looking at removing CO2 from the air with direct air capture and making concrete out of it, basically, using it to make the limestone and then eventually using it to make the actual aggregate that goes into concrete. And we know how big this industry is on the planet. It's a huge deal. So if we, you know, there's different companies, but they're getting nowhere near enough money, and there's far too few companies. This is why I say we need to, I always come back to, let's get the U.S. military budget, and let's put that budget towards getting us out of this, towards preserving our life on this planet and the life of creatures. Spending that money on the tooling with renewables, on ways to capture carbon, on ways to keep the ice in the Arctic. Like, this is why calling it a climate emergency and getting all the countries in the world on board of this is the first step, or at least some of them to get a critical mass going, right? It would cause breaking and slowing down of abrupt climate change.
Might even save us. We do live in amazing times, Paul. I loved your list of things that we could be doing to get the carbon back down. We have super science arriving daily to explain how this planet works. And one thing that you said about the blue planet and about the oceans tweaked me to another piece of science that just came out, saying that the color of the oceans is actually going to change during this century due to climate change. And it sounds good in a way because, oh boy, the seas will be bluer. But you and I know that a blue sea means a dead sea. And really, humans should be thinking we need the dark green seas because that's where all the plankton is and that's where the life is. So if we're going to farm plankton to grab oxygen out of the air, we're going to be doing it closer to the poles because that's where life is going, is closer to the poles on both ends.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, think of the crystal clear, light blue color water that's in the Caribbean and see pictures of these resorts and stuff, and that, well, I mean, the water is that color. That's the natural color of the water without all the organic life in it, without the phytoplankton and zooplankton and all of the marine life in it, because if it's in it, then it doesn't look that color, right? So Sylvie Earle, you know, one of the oceanographers, she says, no blue, no green. You know, no, without the oceans, no blue, we have no green on land. We have no life on land either. So the oceans are 70% of the surface area of the Earth is the oceans, right? So when we think of ways to pull down CO2, you know, we talk about forests and we talk about things, you know, on land, right, for the most part. I mean, the oceans are, I think the oceans are going to save us in the end. I think these carbon dioxide removal techniques and solar radiation management techniques will mostly be ocean-based. And, you know, when I was a kid growing up, Jacques Cousteau was my hero. I wanted to be an oceanographer, but being landlocked, and I never pursued that passion. His son is sort of following in his path, and his son's kids, and they just came out with a documentary recently on life in the ocean. It's fascinating. I just saw it a few nights ago.
I'll have to look for it. Of course, first I'll have to buy a TV that can show it. My old TV isn't so good with those nature videos.
No, it was at a theater. It was surprising to me.
Wow. Okay, so why are you making 500 videos? What are you up to with your YouTube presence?
Well, it wasn't really planned in advance that I'd be so prolific and do this for so long, but I just kind of realized that there's a big gap. There's a huge chasm between science and the general public, right? And very little information crosses that chasm. And I saw this huge need for somebody who can understand, read and understand all of the science and put this in everyday language and communicate this science. And so, as you said at the beginning, there's so much information coming out. Like, the public doesn't have filters, doesn't really know, unless they look at this in detail and have the time to do that, they don't know what's important and what's not. So not only communicating the science to the general public, but actually communicating the things that are the most important, the things that are the most significant that will affect their lives, you know, because of the changing climate. And the problem is that in order to do all of this, then it didn't really allow me to do the individual science myself, right? Which at a university, if you're not becoming so specialized and doing the work in one very specialized narrow area, then you're not going to be really, you know, that's what not recognized by the system. So this is one of the whole problems, the siloing of science and the way the whole scientific system is set up. It's sort of, this specialization has dominated things and problems like climate change have just, you know, gotten way out of hand, not being dealt with, and the risks haven't been communicated to people. You know, I saw this as an important role to take up. So that's sort of what I've done.
Well, you get the picture, people. Paul is the best access point for a kind of planet-wide climate teaching on YouTube, and you can find him at paulbeckwith.net. Or follow his Facebook feed, which is really lively, at paul.beckwith.9. And I will put links to everything we've been talking about here in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. But I really encourage you to go to paulbeckwith.net and to support Paul if you can, because he's really one of the few doorways from science to the public. And he keeps on top of it as it breaks. He brings out a video to explain what James Hansen is saying, to say what all these scientists are saying in plain English that we can all follow. So I sure appreciate you joining us here again this week on Radio EcoShock. Thank you, Paul.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
We don't need no water, let the motherfucker burn.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. And we are experimenting with a brand new format for the podcast. I'm really excited to have my colleague of nearly 10 years, Asa Winstanley of the Electronic Intifada, joining me as co-host. So Asa, over the past few days, you've published a story that is titled Fake Labor Accounts Fueling Anti-Semitism Crisis, in scare quotes. Tell us a little bit about the background to this story and what you found and the significance of those findings.
Yeah, I found a lot of bad things. Like, honestly, researching this story was sort of really diving into the sewer. And it's kind of the tip of the iceberg as well. So essentially what I found was this network of Twitter accounts, which are fake. Like, they use fake photos and fake names, and they just generally look fake. They have fake followers as well. They look like they're bought followers, potentially. Not that many followers, but like just enough to make them, you know, superficially look like maybe they're just somebody's new Twitter account or something like that. But when you dive into it, it's pretty clear that they're fake. And they claim to be Labour Party supporters, Labour Party activists. Some of them claim to be Muslims. Some of them claim to be just sort of quite stereotypical leftists, you know, and stereotypical Muslim sort of extremists, some of them. So they ostensibly, they're Labour Party sort of people. Some of them even claim to be Labour Party staffers or former Labour Party staffers. But what they are posting is really sort of virulent anti-Semitism. You know, there's not really any ambiguity to it at all. You know, it's not even like, oh, someone's gone a bit far there. It's just really horrible, horrible stuff, like real open, violent incitement in some cases, mostly targeting Jews. And these accounts then target high-profile Twitter users, mostly Labour Party verified accounts like Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell, and all Israeli, like Israeli accounts or pro-Israeli accounts. So, like, on the profiles, they look superficially, quite often they look okay. They're just sort of retweeting a few Jeremy Corbyn things or just sort of like a normal Labour activist would. But then, so if you check the replies, if you look at tweets and replies, that's where most of the horrible stuff is. And so then what that means is that if you look at the replies, so say if someone it wants to sort of discredit Jeremy Corbyn, they'll look at his replies when he's talking about something, and they'll then find an anti-Semitic comment by one of these fake accounts. So then what they can say is, well, look at this horrible anti-Semitic thing from Jeremy Corbyn's followers. And there's several instances over the last few years where in this particular troll network that has happened. One of the most recent ones was on the day of the Pittsburgh massacre, where 11 Jewish worshippers were murdered by this neo-Nazi. One of these troll accounts went to Benjamin Netanyahu's Twitter account, the Prime Minister of Israel, and when Netanyahu mentioned the Pittsburgh attack, this account wrote, "You brought this on yourselves." So it's just very horrible, vile anti-Semitism. And it was then drawn attention to by right-wing Labour MPs saying this person's membership is incompatible with the Labour Party. There's no actual evidence that this person even existed, that it was even a real name. The photo was certainly stolen from a local news report, and the person who whose photo it was then, you know, had to sort of do damage control for them, really, and went around on Twitter saying, like, look, this, I'm not this person, that's not my name, but they've stolen my photo, you know, I don't agree with those sentiments. So this poor person, it was a young sort of 21-year-old, I think, young student or postgraduate, I'm not sure, someone fairly young, but they're then having to go around almost apologising for the most vile anti-Semitism, which has actually nothing to do with them. So, you know, these accounts, more often than not, they're then sort of suspended by Twitter, but they just open new ones. So it's a cesspit. And so, like I said, I researched in quite considerable detail over the course of months 10 of these accounts, but there was more. There was actually others, but at a certain point, I just had to stop because the spreadsheet was really time consuming and it was just really sort of horrible as well, actually. You know, it was not really,
yeah,
it was really sort of sewerage work. That's the essence of the story.
And this ties in directly to the kinds of smear campaigns that especially Israel lobby groups and activists in the UK have been waging against Jeremy Corbyn and you know, pro-Palestine, anti-Zionist members of the Labour Party, but also just regular folks in the UK who don't agree with Israel's policies. Can you talk a little bit about the background context here, how these campaigns have been waged over the last couple of years and what kinds of trends you've been spotting?
Yeah, that's completely true. Like So what we've said in the article is we haven't made any claim of who is behind these accounts because we don't know for certain. Okay, so we can't. It's the kind of thing that'd be really hard to prove without any kind of like court case or if this whoever this person or persons was arrested in some way or, you know, charged. Then you could get some sort of evidence of who is behind it, happened in the sort of similar case where in the US where that there was that Israeli teen who was arrested for
He called in a bunch of bomb threats.
That's right. I mean, I mean, that seems to be the case of a disturbed individual rather than anything else as far as we know. But at least in that case, you know, there was some sort of court record there where you could kind of say, well, this is the person who did it. In this case, we don't know. Like, Twitter probably knows more. So we don't know for sure. But having said that, I mean, as you said, like there's a pattern that it clearly fits into. So the Israeli government has been like actively involved over the last few years in like in really a sabotage campaign against Jeremy Corbyn. And you know it fits into their wider sabotage campaign against the BDS movement and Palestine Solidarity movement generally, and I've also mentioned the Integrity Initiative in the article as another covert campaign, a British government campaign, British with close associations with British military intelligence. Just speaking for myself, like my instinct was when I realized these were like a pattern of these accounts being made, after the Squawk Box's reports, and I saw some accounts that the Squawk Box was had reported about this left-wing Labour blog in the UK. They did some good reporting, and they mentioned, and I realised the accounts that these troll accounts they were bringing up were extremely similar to one I'd seen earlier in the year, last year. And I realised there was a pattern there. To me, like, the fact that some of these accounts were pretending to be Muslims and a sort of, like, stereotype of, you know, Muslim terrorists, Muslim extremists, and how they're trying to portray an image of them as all as Muslims as all sort of virulently anti-Semitism. I mean, that's such an Israeli thing to do. Like, it's such a typically Israeli government thing to do. Like, you know, like, it just reminds me of how they infiltrate Palestinian demonstrations so that they can arrest Palestinian, you know, what they see as Palestinian ringleaders or whatever, and disguising themselves as Arabs. And these accounts just had really kind of stupid names, like Abu Hussein, and you know, one of the accounts stole the photo of the brother of one of the main Muslim Brotherhood's main leaders or main ideologues. So Saeed Qutb was one of the original ideologues of the Muslim Brotherhood, and one of these accounts uses his brother's profile photo. So there's almost, like, I don't know, you can kind of. And another one of them was just taken from a Daily Mail story about an alleged ISIS, you know, terrorist who'd been out to Syria or whatever, I think, and had been convicted with some material support for ISIS. So it's just like, it's either, and another one that's supposed to be a leftist has just got a beard, you know, it's supposed to look sort of like a hipster kind of thing.
Right.
So it's kind of ridiculous in a way. So it's kind of ridiculous and laughable, but the stuff they're coming up with is really vile stuff.
Right, and it does real damage. Have you been able to assess what kind of impact this has had on Jeremy Corbyn's campaign or the Labour Party or, you know, Palestine solidarity groups in the UK?
Like, it's definitely, these have, I mean, I detail in the article, like, specific ways that this particular network fed into key moments. It's not that they had, like, a lot of followers, but they were, so it's different from some of the Israeli social media covert influence campaigns, whereas some of the Israel projects Facebook groups had some postings, you know, at least one or two postings that I saw that ran into tens of billions of views. This is a different, far different magnitude than that. It's more about disruption and discrediting rather than influencing per se. But it has an influence on the debate, because then it's sort of magnified by pro-Israel and pro right-wing anti-Jeremy Corbyn forces within the Labour Party. And they're saying, look how terrible this is, kind of thing. And these are the extremists that now want to run the Labour Party. This is what has become of the Labour Party, all this kind of stuff.
Right.
And that's definitely fed into this whole narrative of a so-called anti-Semitism crisis, or even what they're saying is that the Labour Party is institutionally anti-Semitic. That whole narrative has had a massive effect on the Labour Party. It perhaps hasn't had as much of effect as they would wanted it to. To me, one of the main goals has been to actually demoralise the grassroots, because the strength of Corbynism, to me, and I think you see this in the most credible analyses of Corbyn and Corbynism, is the strength of it is actually the movement. That it's not so much about Jeremy Corbyn as a person himself as like a popular movement behind him, that people realised that actually, you know, Parliament is kind of so like seriously, like it's only part of it. And like the reason there was such a grassroots movement behind Jeremy Corbyn was because that he's kind of different to a lot of politicians, although, you know, he has his own weaknesses and everything. But he was already in these movements, so people knew him. And the Palestine movement, the Palestine Solidarity Movement, was one of those movements. So people were prepared to back him because they saw him as, like, coming from the movement, so he could be our representative in government.
Right.
So, like, the goal of this narrative, to me, has been to demoralize that movement and to divide it against itself. And it's definitely had success in that respect. Like, it's really become a really rancorous thing. So it hasn't had maximum effect. So the grassroots of the Labour Party, actual Labour Party members don't believe it. Like, polling shows that they actually don't accept this narrative.
And Corbyn continues to soar in popularity, at least according to people that I trust, you know, on Twitter and in the media. It's like, you know, the more popular he gets, you know, the more kind of desperate and panicked the Israel lobby and activists associated with it are getting.
Yeah, I think so. Like, I mean, I think that these attacks all have all kind of rebounded, you know, like it's made. So during the general election in 2017, the Sun newspaper, which, I mean, I guess the closest American equivalent might be the New York Post or something like that, like just a really horrible
a rag.
Yeah, a really nasty right wing rag, the most despicable, probably the worst newspaper in this country, and with, you know, a crowded field. The Sun newspaper, just the most racist, horrible, Murdoch, you know, piece of toilet paper. Like, it had the front page on election day, and it was literally a sort of a photoshopped thing of a bin with Jeremy Corbyn in the bin, and the headline was Corbyn, like, don't vote for Corbyn, ha ha ha.
And so clever.
Yeah, right. And then the sort of subheads were something like, you know, it was quite a famous headline. It was something like Marxist extremist, you know, friends with Hamas, IRA sympathizer, you know, put him in the bin, something like that. And it seemed to have the opposite effect, like, on actual voters. And despite, like, actual years of media propaganda just vilifying him, it was really a moral victory to me, the election. Like, it wasn't an outright victory. Obviously, you know, he didn't become prime minister. But considering he was, like, projected to be wiped out and he was, like, I don't know, just ridiculous amounts behind in the polls at the outset, the election victory was actually the election result was actually a stunning success. Like, it denied Theresa May an outright majority, and it reduced her representation, the Conservative Party's representation in Parliament, where the whole point of her calling the election was to try and really deal a blow to the Labour Party. So yeah, these things, like, mostly have a real ricochet effect, and people, it has the effect of, like, people pay attention. It's sort of the no publicity is bad publicity to an extent. It brings Corbyn's name up and it makes him a kind of outsider. So that there is a kind of Trump effect there, except he sort of uses his powers for good instead of evil, obviously. So that, like, yeah, people are like, oh, this Jeremy Corbyn, what? And then people would see when it was policies that are actually popular, you know. So this is the thing, they're trying to make him out as this Marxist extremist. And, like, we might wish he was, but he's not. Like, so, like, it's just things like things that used to be actually the right wing of the Labour Party in this country, or even, like, some conservative governments, like in the 70s, would have supported, of just having, you know, basic national infrastructure, really, is what his policies are. It's popular. So when people see it actually articulated properly, they support it. But the anti-Semitism thing has just kept coming back because, to me, the reason that it's kept coming back is that it's driven. Like, it's a narrative that's driven because it's had an effect. It does have a demoralising effect on people, because people, I was just talking to, another Labour activist today, and it's just like, oh no, this again, you know. And it's not that there's any substance to it. Not that there's no anti-Semitism at all, because of course it exists in the Labour Party, as it exists in society. But all the actual figures from facts show that levels of anti-Semitism are lower in the Labour Party than in any other party. But this whole narrative of crisis is really invented. It's invented, you know, it's exaggerated, and it's outright fabricated in many cases. And this is, to me, is like the most frustrating thing of reporting on this over the last few years, is that like people are just like, oh, the anti-Semitism crisis. And it just literally, the first headlines about it were literally just invented. Like it was, and there's been no accounting for that at all. And that, to me, that should be the starting point, really. And I think even a lot of people on the left in this country, like, sort of forget that.
This edition of the Electronic Intifada podcast will be continued next week.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Miguel Tinker Salas, professor of Latin American Studies and History, who assesses the current political and economic crisis in Venezuela and the role of the Trump administration in its attempt to oust current President Nicolas Maduro from power. William Rivers Pitt, senior editor and lead columnist with TruthOut.org, who considers the prospects for a bipartisan deal being made to avoid another government shutdown or a Trump emergency declaration bypassing Congress to get funding for his border wall. And Leticia Colon de Mejias, founder and CEO of Efficiency for All, who talks about the importance of energy policy and its relationship to equity for all people and the environment. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Outside the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, the Hong Kong-based NGO Crossroads Foundation played out a simulation known as A Day in the Life of a Refugee. It gave the bankers and CEOs who participated a taste of what life is like for asylum seekers, many of whom are targets of violent crime. With anti-immigration political parties and reactionary policies gaining support in Western nations, the aid group that runs the simulation wants politicians, officials, and chief executives attending Davos to understand the issue from the frightening perspective of a refugee. The United Nations recently leveled criticism at European nations for preventing boatloads of migrants from disembarking at safe ports and relying instead on Libya's Coast Guard to return them to the dangerous North African country. 3 years ago, the European Union pressured Niger, a major transit point for migrants, to criminalize the transport of foreigners north to the Africa coast. In exchange, the EU is underwriting jobs for former smugglers. The program, in part, has helped to reduce migration from Niger to Europe by more than 75%. However, many human traffickers are now seeking more remote and perilous travel routes to take migrants through the Sahara Desert, a path which carries a far greater risk of death. In late March 2018, Mexican Marines carried out a late-night raid on a house in the border city of Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, detaining two men, a local car mechanic, and a friend from Oaxaca planning to cross the border to the U.S. The two men were among 51 people in Nuevo Laredo who disappeared during the first 5 months of 2018. Over the last 12 years, some 37,000 Mexicans have disappeared during Mexico's bloody war on drugs. Family members of the disappeared are putting pressure on Mexico's new president, Manuel López Obrador, also known as AMLO. During his election campaign, Obrador pledged to investigate the fate of 43 students from a teacher's college who disappeared in 2014. But The Nation magazine reports that AMLO has been virtually silent about the tens of thousands of other Mexicans who have disappeared. Last November, Mexico's Supreme Court overturned a law that permits the Mexican army to engage in law enforcement activities. But by the end of Obrador's first week in office, 50,000 military police were deployed to 150 regions of the country. López Obrador asserts that these units will be combined into a new National Guard force over the next 3 years, and eventually will be under the command of the army. However, critics maintain that AMLO's plan is a repeat of the mistake of militarization from the previous two administrations. The day after the partial U.S. government shutdown began, the Internal Revenue Service sent out a notice of intent to seize the property of California businessman Aaron Cadell, who had been in settlement talks with the IRS. During the recently ended partial government shutdown, IRS computers continued to crank out asset seizure notices, but there were few people still working at the IRS call centers to deal with complaints. According to Intercept, many small businesses were trapped in a Kafkaesque maze with no way of settling tax disputes. Cadell, who owns a small chain of bakeries, claims the IRS made a mistake on the status of his payroll tax deposits, but settlement talks ended with the government shutdown and an asset seizure letter was sent out. Cadell surmised that other individuals and businesses were in the same catch-22 situation. Perhaps the most out-of-luck people in the recently ended shutdown are the thousands of workers the federal government pays the least, low-wage contract workers who perform janitorial, security, and food service tasks at public buildings. Unlike furloughed federal employees who will receive back pay for wages missed, contract workers will likely receive no restitution. However, some Democrats in Congress, including freshman House member Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts and Senator Tina Smith of Minnesota, support legislation that would reinstate back pay for low-wage contract workers who were held hostage during this longest government shutdown in U.S. history. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Venezuela, already gripped by a severe political and economic crisis, is now the focus of a concerted effort by the Trump administration to oust the South American nation's socialist president, Nicolas Maduro. Juan Guaido, opposition party president of the National Assembly, declared himself interim president of the country during a massive anti-government protest on January 23rd, not long after Maduro was sworn into office for a second term. The Trump administration recognized Guaido as Venezuela's legitimate president, maintaining that the May 20th election won by Maduro lacked credibility. Canada, the European Union, and other Latin American nations governed by conservatives followed the U.S. lead, insisting that Maduro step down and new elections be called. However, in this escalating crisis, Maduro retains the support of Russia, China, Mexico, Bolivia, Uruguay, Cuba, Iran, Syria, and Turkey. On January 28th, President Trump's National Security Advisor, John Bolton, announced new additional sanctions against Venezuela's state-owned oil company, depriving Maduro's government of $7 billion in assets and $3 billion more by the end of the year. The imposition of new sanctions was preceded by the Trump appointment of Elliot Abrams as the administration's new special envoy on the Venezuelan crisis, who's well known for his guilty plea for lying to Congress during the Iran-Contra scandal and his association with Central American death squads during the U.S. dirty wars in the region. Your reporter spoke with Miguel Tinker Salas, professor of Latin American Studies and History at Pomona College, who assesses the current political and economic crisis in Venezuela and the risk of civil war resulting from U.S. intervention.
I think that the overall crisis boils down to the fact that Guaido, by declaring himself the interim president, is a non-elected figure. He was a relatively unknown figure in the National Assembly. And to be immediately recognized by the Trump administration, the conservative governments of South America, Brazil, Argentina, Chile, and Colombia, and then within a matter of hours by the European Union, speaks to a very much of an orchestrated effort here to unseat Nicolas Maduro, which is relatively unprecedented in Latin America. We've had other efforts at constitutional coups, whether they be with Juan Beltrán Aristide in Haiti, or with Mr. Zelaya in Honduras, or even with Chavez in 2002, where the U.S. and the Bush administration backed a coup against Chavez, arguing that he had resigned his post. So that in one way we see is a coup. That does not negate the fact that Venezuela is facing a severe economic crisis, where shortages of foodstuffs and medicine are a daily occurrence, where 3 million people have left the country, and where Maduro has proven incompetent in running the economy. But if that's the condition, the reality is that what is being attempted is an effort to unseat president, claiming that he's not legitimate, claiming because the opposition did not participate in the May 20th election, that somehow he is no longer legitimate, and that foreign powers can dictate who will be the president of Venezuela. And that's a very, very problematic precedent for democracy in Latin America.
Professor Salas, what are the chances, as Nicolas Maduro has called for, mediation by the United Nations and the Vatican to address this problem in a nonviolent way, in a manner that won't create more upheaval for the people of Venezuela?
I think it's right now the odds are very, very little. The opposition has essentially opted for the policy of foreign powers and pressuring Maduro by not participating in the May 20th election and by walking away from the negotiating table when José Luis Zapatero, the former Spanish minister, was negotiating with the opposition and the government rules of engagement, and walking away from that. They essentially have clearly demarcated the fact that they are not interested in negotiations. They seek the ouster. And the problem is that in seeking the ouster of a government, whether you like him or not, what you're doing is creating conditions for instability. Because what's to say tomorrow Maduro is ousted and now the Chavistas are in the opposition and they do the same thing to those who have assumed power? My point being that there has to be a negotiated settlement, that is the only possible solution. And by recognizing Guaido, by pushing for a break in the military, by putting the society with sanctions between the rock and the hard spot, they've essentially eliminated a negotiating option from the table and have made Maduro's departure the only issue subject to conversation.
Professor Salas, what are the chances are that we could see armed conflict break out in Venezuela in a much more substantial way than the street violence we've seen in recent years? What about the United States' intervention at this point? There's even been talk from the Trump administration that they're not taking the sending of U.S. troops to Venezuela off the table for possible future policies they may pursue. What are your concerns around U.S. intervention, or with the United States backing a surrogate force taking up arms and fighting the Venezuelan military?
That's my greatest concern. We, those who can recall the Dominican Republic, recognize that the Johnson administration hid behind a so-called multinational force that involved the Brazilians and others. Bolsonaro has already spoken openly about wanting to oust Maduro. So has Iván Duque in Colombia. So have other governments in Latin America. That's why, again, I say they are not interested in democracy in Latin America. They're interested in regime change in Venezuela. Today, Bolton, as he spoke with Mnuchin to announce the new sanctions against Venezuela, on his yellow briefing paper that he had, was written 5,000 U.S. troops to Colombia. That could have been psychological ops, or it could have been U.S. troops being sent to Colombia. And again, when you have something like that happening, the first thing one thinks about is some sort of incident, a border incident, something happens, as we saw with the Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam, or as we saw in the case of Iraq, and so-called weapons of mass destruction. Any of those things can happen as a pretext or as a precursor to then be able to take part in an intervention. And that's what worries me the most, because that would be disastrous for Venezuela and it would be disastrous for Latin America. And long-term, these invasions have not gone good. If you're in the U.S., you can only think of what's happened in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Honduras, in Haiti, in El Salvador. The record is one of death and destruction.
That was Miguel Tinker Salas, professor of Latin American Studies, History, Chicana and Latina Studies at Pomona College. Find more analysis of the Venezuela crisis by visiting our Between the Lines website
at btlonline.org. After delivering a speech on January 25th that ended the longest government shutdown in U.S. history, President Trump agreed to a temporary funding measure that allowed federal employees to return to work. That legislation, however, doesn't include any funds he demanded to build his southern border wall. In fact, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office reported that the U.S. economy lost $11 billion, including $3 billion that's gone forever, during the 35 days of the partial federal government shutdown. As he reopened the government, the president threatened to shut it down again or declare a national emergency if Democrats and Republicans failed to negotiate a deal to provide $5.7 billion in funding for his U.S.-Mexico border wall by February 15th. During his TV speech, Mr. Trump repeated his discredited attacks on immigrants and refugees, blaming them for a host of problems in the U.S. According to a recent Quinnipiac University national poll, 56% of Americans surveyed blamed Trump and Republican leaders for the shutdown, with only 34% saying they believed Democrats were responsible. Your reporter spoke with William Rivers Pitt, senior editor and lead columnist with truthout.org, who assesses the prospects for a bipartisan deal being made to avoid another government shutdown or a Trump emergency declaration bypassing Congress to get border wall funding.
So in terms of what I think is going to come out of the next 3 weeks, there's an element of massive uncertainty involved, of course, because you have this thing in the White House who agrees with the last person he talked to, and 9 times out of 10, lately, the last person he talks to is Stephen Miller, who is the most shining fascist we've had anywhere near the federal government since Curtis LeMay. So you could give him 10 walls and a partridge in a pear tree, and he could still decide to throw the thing into disorder. So there's that, and that's just the elephant in the room, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. My strong suspicion is that the conversation is going to be less about making Trump happy and more about putting together a reasonable package, even a smaller one, because immigration is an incredibly complex issue, and 3 weeks is probably not enough to get it done. So some sort of Band-Aid package that allows him to get out of this with some sort of face, no wall, and a long, hard conversation from the people in the Republican Congress, Mitch McConnell and the rest of them, about the exact weight of the building that will fall on him and the entire Republican Party if he either shuts down the government again or declares an emergency for a non-existent emergency and winds up immediately in court and doesn't get his money anyway. Friday was one of the happiest days that I've had in a really, really long time, but we are still 40 miles of bad road ahead of us before anything starts to make sense again. That's just the fact.
William Rivers Pitt, are you concerned that a coalition of moderate Democrats and Republicans in the House would put together a package of $5.7 billion of funding for a smart wall or more agents, more immigration judges? Are you concerned that this would validate Trump's declaration that there is an emergency at the border, that it would confirm to his base that he was right all along, that the Democrats closed down the government unnecessarily because they didn't come over to Trump's side?
It bothers me. It bothers me deeply. And if we had more than 3 weeks to kick it around, I'm certain that we could probably come up with something. But this is disaster government, like disaster capitalism. The guy has set the building on fire. Now he's haggling over the price of the hose. I mean, there is absolutely no emergency down at the border. But if this guy goes and shuts the government down, we already saw what was about to happen. It is a damn miracle that nobody got killed with the airline safety being affected the way it was. The other areas that the shutdown was affecting, battered women's shelters were being closed down because they lacked funding. I have not read any reports that someone who was being abused was unable to get to a shelter and was hurt or killed, but that could very easily have happened. Medical treatment on Native reservations essentially ceased to exist, so there were people being hurt there. And if it had gone on much longer, we were going to get into money for SNAP and a variety of other issues that the White House didn't give a tinker's damn about. All they were focused on was airline travel, because as some funny guy on TV the other day. I can't remember. I think it might have been Bill Maher. He was like, yeah, the reason why he opened the government again is because his rich friends were telling him they couldn't get from D.C. to Washington.
The
unfortunate truth is that the threat of the shutdown is very real, and we're going to have to face him down and force him to do it again rather than give him this stupid wall. But I suspect that if an opportunity to come up with something, especially if it includes protections, permanent protections for the Dreamers, the DACA Act kids, and we could fold that into whatever this happens to be and just choke on the increase in agents and the electric wall, that might be something that would happen. It would make me deeply unhappy, but I am I'm casting around for alternatives given the people we're dealing with, and I'm not coming up with very many.
That was William Rivers Pitt, senior editor and lead columnist with truthout.org. Find more commentary and analysis on Trump's demand for a border wall and the recent government shutdown by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A half dozen scientific reports released in the past 4 months show that the Earth is well on its way to becoming unsustainable for humans and other life forms. A special report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says humanity has just a dozen years or so to keep greenhouse gas emissions below the threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius warming over the pre-industrial age in order to prevent disastrous and irreversible changes to Earth's climate. That requires nations collectively around the world to sharply reduce to zero the amount of greenhouse gas emissions released into the atmosphere. The easiest and cheapest method of reducing carbon emissions, apart from not burning fossil fuels, is through energy efficiency. At the January 12th Achieving Our Shared Energy Goals Forum in Hartford, Connecticut, sponsored by the group Efficiency for All, speakers addressed the ways individuals and governments can reduce their energy use. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Leticia Colon de Mejias, founder and CEO of Efficiency for All, based in Windsor, Connecticut, which is an educational and outreach nonprofit focused on sustainability and leadership training for underrepresented and at-risk communities. Here, Mejias explains the importance of energy policy and its relationship to equity for all people and the environment.
So I wanted to find a way to explain energy policy and energy processes to the common people of the world who don't work in energy and therefore don't understand where energy comes from or how we use it. And energy policy is much like any law policy. It has a mix of information in there, making the sausage, so to speak. So energy in Connecticut is 95% non-renewable and 5% renewable. But no matter how we generate our electricity, how we use it, and what we do with it, impacts all people. And so I came up with an analogy that our energy mix is similar to making rice and beans. When we're creating energy policy or our energy mix for the state of Connecticut, that if we utilize efficiency as a demand reduction and draw down consumption as the basis, which would be, I call, the rice of it, then we can throw in any beans we'd like. And those beans can be diverse. They could be red beans. They could be black beans. And I like to say they could be things like wind or solar, or they might be carbon reduction like nuclear, or they might be gas pipelines. But whatever type of mix we make with our recipe, who writes the recipe and who cooks the recipe and how that recipe is ultimately served depends on what dish we get in the end. But no matter how we develop a recipe or who cooks it or writes it or what spices we choose to put in it, it's important that everyone gets a dish of rice and beans. It is very important that we have a strategy, that having a goal without a plan is just a wish. And in order to meet the carbon reduction goals and the energy demand reduction goals and move towards a cleaner, renewable, sustainable energy source like 100% renewable or some groups' goals and request, that you have to do that strategically. So, for example, we can't continue expanding gas for heating and expanding gas for electric generation and still want a low-carbon future. gas is just a fossil fuel like oil or like coal. So if we want to move in that direction, then we need to have a strategy that brings us there over time. So we would say we're going to decrease demand by 30% using efficiency and making the thermal boundaries of buildings tighter so we're not wasting heating and cooling loads. And then that would decrease our demand on our gas supplies, which becomes a problem. And every time we increase gas demand for electricity or heating and cooling, we actually increase our electric rates because it's the same gas that we use to generate electricity. And if we want to, let's say some groups would like to electrify heating and cooling to get off of oil or propane, which are dirty fossil fuels in people's mind, and I agree. But in order to do that, we can't plug into the electricity that is generated by gas and nuclear, although considered to be a less carbon-intense source of energy. Gas is also just a fossil fuel that is extracted from the ground. So we should be looking for fuels that aren't requiring drilling, digging, blowing things up, like wind and solar, hydroelectric, that are more renewable.
One of the speakers who followed you last Saturday, she put a hat on, and a floppy hat, and said that she wanted to glam up her pitch about energy efficiency. She feels like it's not considered as glamorous as talking about all these different exciting renewables. Do you agree? And what do you say about that? How do you get people more excited about energy efficiency?
Although not as sexy as solar or wind or carbon trading or carbon taxing, efficiency does absolutely draw down our carbon emissions, therefore protecting human health, lowering the cost of energy, increasing the efficacy of our renewable resources, and really meeting the common goal of growing our economy as well and stabilizing energy so we don't have things like brownouts and blackouts, which are real in other places. So efficiency has really been overlooked, although it has consistently met the demand reduction goals of the state of Connecticut and has a 1-7 return on investment and affords Connecticut 34,000 local jobs, generates $1.4 billion of gross state product and $140 million of net tax revenue. We silly decided to divert that really effective program, again, 1-7 return on investment, and dump it into our general fund, which isn't returning anything in as far as economic growth goes to the state of Connecticut. And so what we're doing is calling for common sense policies as they relate to energy and ensuring that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater while chasing the idea of something fancy or shiny. But at the end of the day, really, it's just the simple concept of using less to do more and making really intelligent choices and not knee-jerk reactions to policies in our state.
That was Leticia Colon de Mejias, founder of Efficiency for All and Green Eco Warriors, nonprofits focused on sustainability and leadership training for underrepresented and at-risk communities. Learn more about how communities are advancing energy efficiency by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Deprogram Radio World in Norwich, Norfolk, United Kingdom, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, KKRN in Round Mountain, California, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Babies in chains. They're beautiful babies when you see photos of those tykes. Bright-eyed, curious, little bundles of endless energy. Except their energies thrown into metallic American cages called detention centers. Separated from their parents by the U.S. government, have left their little forms, drawn into death by American carelessness, American uncaring, American hatreds. Jacqueline and Felipe, children of South America, brought north to taste a little bit of America, have been ignored into non-existence because they're children of migrants and thus demonized. They were children of sunlight, of childish glee and joy, of life renewing itself. They could have been children of a new America were it not for the president of old America, who sent them into detention for being the wrong color, the wrong language. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jabal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Pennsylvania state prisoner, who is the named plaintiff in a civil rights suit against the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. The other two plaintiffs are David Maldonado and Daniel Levia, is suing DOC on behalf of thousands of Pennsylvania state prisoners suffering from hepatitis C and its notorious side effects. That case may have reached a powerful turning point, as both sides have reached a proposed settlement agreement. In that proposed settlement, Chimenti et al. Versus Pennsylvania DOC proposes to treat 1,500 men and women, of course, who have F2, F3, and F4 fibrosis or Medivir scores within 6 months, and an additional 1,500 hepatitis patients during the next year with powerful drugs known as DAAs, or direct-acting antiviral drugs. After 2020, 2,000 people are to be treated annually. The settlement agreement has to first be approved by the U.S. District Court in Philadelphia after a hearing in early February 2019. If the judge agrees, the go date will be July 1st, 2019. Mr. Chimenti was seeking Hep C treatment as far back as 2010, when it was determined that he suffered stage 4 cirrhosis of his liver due to the infection. He and his co-plaintiffs filed suit initially in 2015 and in 2017 filed an amended complaint. Earlier in 2018, the court declared Chimenti a class action. The Chimenti class is represented by renowned civil rights lawyer David Rudofsky and Su Ming Ye of the Pennsylvania Institutional Law Project in Philadelphia. If this proposed settlement agreement is signed into law, it will be a groundbreaking change in how the state and prisons handle hepatitis C cases. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Comrades and friends of ILWU Local 10 on the move. I join you all in celebrating the remarkable life and struggle of ILWU's longest living member, Howard Kaler, a trade unionist and revolutionary who used labor power to defend every major social movement for freedom, justice, and workers' rights the world over. From opposing the vicious apartheid system in South Africa to opposing the American Nazi group, from strikes against police brutality to struggling for my life and freedom in 1999, Howard's life work is a reflection of ILWU's battles and struggles, yes, but it's also a reflection of the human rights movement for much of the 20th century, and yet, even the 21st. Brother Howard, I salute you. You bring great honor to the ILWU, and you serve as a powerful example of labor power. Happy 93rd birthday, brother. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Can a company backed by neocons be trusted to regulate internet news sites as to their reliability? How might social media sites like Facebook be forced to embrace tools which jeopardize independent media? What is the Integrity Initiative, and how is it interfering with political processes in the UK and abroad? How might a Canadian federal government bid to have a five-person panel monitor foreign interference in elections serve to marginalize dissent? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, we examine the hidden agenda behind efforts to patrol fake news proliferating on Facebook and other media platforms, and what it means for the future of dissident opinion and independent, non-corporate media. We will hear first from Whitney Webb about her expose on the recently spawned news rating agency and fact-checker NewsGuard. We next hear from Patrick Henningsen, geopolitical analyst and founder of 21st Century Wire, about other mechanisms to control and contain the flow of information that challenges the narratives enabling militarism and corporate profiteering. On this week's program, Who Guards the Guardians? NewsGuard, the Integrity Initiative, and other threats to an independent press. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 8th, 2019. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabeg-Akin, the homeland of the Métis and the traditional territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. In the specific case of withdrawing from the INF, there is little need to raise a big hue and cry, as was the case with the Paris Agreement, as the media intelligence military apparatus has a lot to gain from this. This just goes to show how the MSM and their rolled-out experts thrive on war and the money that is to be made from it. There's a major psyop going on to convince the American public that the withdrawal from the INF treaty and the resulting arms race with major nuclear-armed countries is apparently the best way to keep America safe. The withdrawal from the INF treaty opens the gates for a new nuclear arms race that will bring great advantages to arms industries with great returns for shareholders, executives, and CEOs, all paid for by the American taxpayer. It is more than probable that the official defense budget in 2020, having to cover for the development of weapons previously prohibited by the INF treaty, could be more than $800 billion, seeing an increase of tens of billions of dollars in the space of 12 months. That comes from the article, One Step Closer to Nuclear Oblivion, U.S. Sabotages the INF Treaty, by Federico Pieraccini, posted February 6th, originally published at Strategic Culture Foundation. Just as the government shutdown ended, the U.S. Bureau of Land Management quietly listed many new sites in their attempt to expand the sale of oil and gas leases. Among those sites includes land outside Chaco Culture National Park and other public land revered by Native Americans, the Associated Press reported. The Great Chaco region in New Mexico, which includes Chaco Canyon, is a major center of ancient Pueblo culture and a UNESCO World Heritage Site, EcoWatch reported. Oil and gas has already devastated our state's air quality, water quality, and flow and public health, Rebecca Sobel, senior climate and energy campaigner for Wild Earth Guardians, said. Quote, it's clear that Trump administration will stop at nothing to sacrifice public interest for private profits, unquote. That comes from the article, U.S. Bureau of Land Management lists sacred land outside Chaco Culture National Historical Park in newest fracking lease sale by Ashley Curtin, posted February 6th, originally appearing at Nation of Change. Twitter and the DFRL appear to be turning a blind eye to violations of Twitter policy from pro-opposition networks while taking aim at allegedly pro-government disinformation operations, while neither has provided evidence of such a campaign by the government. In many ways, the war in Syria served as a testing ground for propaganda tools, from the U.S.-funded civil defense group White Helmets to U.S.-backed Kurdish fighters who were portrayed as defenders of an anarchist commune in the north. But Venezuela today exists in an even more precarious position online due to the advent of institutions and quote-unquote experts that have made a name for themselves in the frenzy that has followed allegations that Russia used coordinated inauthentic behavior to sway the 2016 presidential elections, even more so because social media giants like Twitter and Facebook have acquiesced. For example, back in July, Twitter and Facebook were unaware of any state actors manipulating social media besides Russia. Since then, they have levied such accusations against Iran and now Venezuela. That comes from the article, Twitter Greenlights Venezuela's Pro-Opposition Online Blitz Shuts Down Genuine Opponents, by Alexander Rubinstein, posted February 6th, originally published at Mint Press News. International criminal lawyer Christopher C. Black explains quite clearly in The Lima Group International Outlaws that the world can see that the Lima gang, who like to use the phrase the rule of law in their diktats to others, are committing egregious crimes under international law, and together these crimes are components of the supreme war crime of aggression. The Lima Group, therefore, is a group of international criminal conspirators, and the every individual involved is a war criminal. So when the Lima conspirators issue their press statement after the Ottawa meeting, planning aggression against Venezuela, calling for the overthrow for the head of President Maduro, and dressing it up in the usual language of the aggressor of human rights and democracy, and their fake and illegal doctrine of responsibility to protect, it will not be issued by nations interested in peace or who have respect for international law, but by a gang of criminals, of international outlaws, from NEO. That comes from the article, The Lima Group, Conspiracy to Destroy Venezuela, by Mark Taliano, posted February 6th with files from New Eastern Outlook. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. On March 5th, 2018, two longtime journalists and media entrepreneurs, Stephen Brill and Gordon Krovitz, announced the launch of NewsGuard, a company that claims to be dedicated to restoring trust and accountability and using journalism to fight false news, misinformation, and disinformation. According to NewsGuard's criteria, news sites are judged as to their reliability, rated according to background, content, and ownership. The news rating agency was ushered in on a wave of concern about the proliferation of fake news on the internet, which, it is argued, skewed the 2016 presidential election in Donald Trump's favor, and which may have been masterminded by Russian authorities. NewsGuard is running into some resistance from independent media outlets, from the general public, and even from the social media giants being tasked with inoculating their platforms from the scourge of false information and disinformation. Much of the pushback is likely attributable to a major expose from Mint Press News, published on January 9th. This in-depth report discloses the backgrounds of the figures driving the NewsGuard initiative, suggesting an ulterior motive to their fact-checking project. The author of the exposé is Whitney Webb. Whitney is a staff writer for Mint Press News. Her work has appeared in a number of online outlets, including Global Research, the Ron Paul Institute, and 21st Century Wire. She's also a past guest of this program. The Global Research NewsHour reached out to Whitney recently and asked what drove her to investigate NewsGuard and about the specific concerns she had about the people backing it.
Mint Press, where I write, was originally contacted by this group and asked us to answer a series of questions that, from our perspective, seemed very biased. And, you know, it was very clear from the questions they had not even bothered to really look at our page. And you know, there were questions that were worded in such a way to put us on the defensive right away. So it really seemed like there was more to this group than met the eye originally. And so we're still in the process of being raided, supposedly. But anyway, after asking these questions, you know, my Mint Press's editor, Manar Mukhawesh, she asked me to look into the group to see if I could find anything, you know, go on the offensive rather than wait for us to label us unreliable or smear us or anything like that. And that's how I actually ended up writing this expose, because this group, which a lot of you had sort of slipped under the radar before, you know, their connections to all of these, you know, people, former government figures, people in establishment media, neocon think tanks, you know, we're all there, but no one had really heard of NewsGuard. And that's because, you know, only really in the past 2 or 3 months, they've been doing this big media blitz to really promote themselves, at least in mainstream media outlets, as the answer to the fake news problem, which I think is, you know, troubling when you consider who's on their board of advisors and who founded NewsGuard. And we can go into that in a little bit of detail. Either now or at a later point, but it's, you know, the connections these people have, you know, just by virtue of their advisory board, I think is something that has raised a lot of red flags for people. So as an example, you mentioned that the 9/11 color-coded terror alert that was implemented by Tom Ridge when he was Secretary of Homeland Security under George W. Bush, and he is on the board of advisors of NewsGuard. Another person that we find there is Michael Hayden, who was former director of the CIA, former director of the NSA, and he's also a principal at the Chertoff Group, which is, you know, funded co-founded by Michael Chertoff, who was also another Secretary of Homeland Security, who's also the current board chairman of one of the world's top weapons manufacturers, BAE Systems. You also have Richard Stengel, who described himself at a panel discussion hosted last year at the Council on Foreign Relations. He described himself as Barack Obama's, quote, chief propagandist at the State Department, and openly admitted that he wasn't against propaganda and felt that every country needs to do it, and he doesn't think it's, quote, that awful, which I think is significant when you consider the fact that NewsGuard claims that it is, you know, you should trust them because they're veteran journalists and they have, you know, appropriate opinions about what is reliable and what is not reliable, and that, you know, they are trustworthy and independent and nonpartisan. They use these words, independent, nonpartisan, a lot in their own material promoting them, right? But when you look at, you know, these people on their advisory board, you also have other people that are connected to major PR or PR firms, a former White House communications director, head of PBS, other people that are very much in the establishment media business as well. So I think that, you know, has raised a lot of red flags for people. But also, I mean, if you look at the CEOs themselves, you know, there's two CEOs, two founders of NewsGuard, the most troubling of which, in my opinion, is Lewis Gordon Krowitz, who used to basically, you know, had a top position in the Dow Jones, you know, of Wall Street. He was also publisher of the Wall Street Journal until that was sold to Rupert Murdoch's group. He's also a board member of Business Insider, which has received tens of millions of dollars from Jeff Bezos, who himself owns the Washington Post. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's also closely connected to the American Enterprise Institute, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners will know that the American Enterprise Institute is probably, if not the most, you know, influential neoconservative think tank in the country. You know, it's the figures, the scholars, and its directors and its fellows, you know, have included people like Paul Wolfowitz, you know, the architect of the Iraq War, Richard Pearl, John Bolton, Frederick Kagan. They were really instrumental on, you know, the War on Terror, and you know, the expansion of the military empire and all of these things.
What you're pointing out with these examples of the advisory board and Krowitz as a co-CEO is that they are all literally invested in narratives that enable military adventurism around the world, among other things.
Exactly. And that's why we see a lot of bias, for example, in the sites that it has already rated green and red, or in other words, reliable and unreliable. The most glaring example of this, in my opinion, is that they rated WikiLeaks unreliable, which I think is very telling, because even though they admit that WikiLeaks has perfect accuracy, They claim it's unreliable because it has never published corrections for errors it has made, even though it admits it has made no errors, which is, you know, clearly an underhanded move to try and prevent people who use NewsGuard to not read WikiLeaks. And if you look at the people, you know, that I just mentioned, a lot of them, particularly Michael Hayden, for example, have been, you know, against WikiLeaks, adamantly against WikiLeaks, and have also promoted the prosecution of Julian Assange. Krovitz himself actually wrote a Wall Street Journal column about how Julian Assange should be prosecuted under the Espionage Act. Which I think is itself very telling. So, you know, you're also seeing a lot of, you know, and basically, you know, it's promoted itself as nonpartisan on the fact that it has also, you know, rated conservative and, you know, left-leaning establishment news sites all green, claiming that makes it nonpartisan. But what you see, if you start to look at all the different ratings that NewsGuard has given to these websites, is that consistently establishment news websites or news websites that promote establishment narratives are green, and those that are rated red are very often ones that do not, right? Or ones that challenge those narratives. Obviously, in the red, you get a whole, you know, the red-rated sites are a mixed bag because, of course, you're going to get some, you know, false pages in there that NewsGuard, you know, most frequently touts those, like, three pages in particular as being the examples of why their service is necessary and why their research by, quote, veteran journalists is helpful and beneficial in all of this. But what they don't tell you is that, you know, the people in this organization, it's CEOs and the people that are also, you know, it's investors, which we can get to in a little bit, and its board of advisors all have a vested interest in maintaining establishment narratives. And as we know, and as we've seen, as this fight against so-called fake news has gone on, is that this is really about silencing challenges to establishment narratives. Because, you know, if you can make your point with facts and evidence, and those facts and evidence challenge an establishment narrative, you know, that's a threat to these people and a lot of the organizations they're connected to.
Now, you mentioned or alluded to some of the major investors in this group, one of them being Publicis Group, which is a major global communicator. And then you state in your article that they're among their top clients are pharmaceutical giants like Eli Lilly, Merck, Pfizer, and Bayer Monsanto, as well as companies like Starbucks, Procter & Gamble, McDonald's, Kraft Heinz, Burger King, and the governments of Australia and Saudi Arabia. You know, and anyone, all of these entities are, you know, are worthy of criticism and informed criticism. And you're suggesting there's a conflict there, you know, with the advisors, you know, when these are clients of one of the investors of this NewsGuard organization, that could potentially flag critics like Global Research or Mint Press News or other outlets, right?
Right. Well, the fact that the Publicis Group there is significant in a large part also because of a service that NewsGuard is offering to corporations that is called BrandGuard. And what BrandGuard does is that if you opt into it, you can blacklist sites that are rated red by NewsGuard from your ads, which basically would deprive all red-rated sites from ad revenue from companies that buy into BrandGuard. And by virtue of the fact that the Publicis Group is a major investor in BrandGuard and represents all these major corporations, you know, strongly suggests to me that there is basically a built-in market for this BrandGuard already that would be Publicis Group clients that also, you know, for obvious reasons, have interest in establishment narratives. And I think, you know, in my opinion, at least, when we look at the rankings of sites and whatnot, you know, the fact that the Publicis Group represents basically the pretty much all of the most powerful pharmaceutical companies in the world, it's really interesting to see that NewsGuard consistently rates a lot of alternative health pages or natural health pages red, which is actually really interesting because, you know, even ones that are like, you know, like Dr. Mercola, his website, which is like, he's a New York Times bestseller and promoter of natural medicine and natural remedies and all this stuff. You know, he's been marked as unreliable. And, you know, obviously these pharmaceutical companies have a vested interest in people not pursuing alternatives to pharmaceutical, cures or, you know, medications, things like that, them looking for alternative cures. to health problems. Obviously, they have a vested interest in against that. So it's interesting to see that NewsGuard has actually generated backlash from the natural health community. And actually, when I was doing research on NewsGuard, the only people that I had seen write about NewsGuard previous to my report on them were alternative, were natural health sites, which I think is significant in that case. There's several other investors that are troubling in NewsGuard as well. You have a top executive at U.S. government contractor, Booz Allen Hamilton. You have Thomas Glocer, who's former CEO of Thomson Reuters. He's also a board, a member of the board at Merck, a massive pharmaceutical company. He's also on the board of Morgan Stanley and on the Council on Foreign Relations and also the Atlantic Council, right? So we also have the Blue Haven Initiative is a major investor in NewsGuard as well. And this, interestingly enough, the Blue Haven Initiative is the impact investment fund of the Pritzker family, which is one of the wealthiest families in the United States. Most people might know them as the owners of the Hyatt hotel chain. But what a lot of people don't know is that their family was also the second largest financial contributor to Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign. And if we remember back to that election, you know, all this stuff about fake news and whatnot started because Hillary Clinton lost that campaign. And what was one of the things that her campaign and she eventually ended up blaming for that loss? Fake news. So it's really interesting to see, you know, this group or this family, you know, oligarch family, you know, being connected to this outfit of news ranking sites fighting so-called fake news.
NewsGuard has been having some difficulty getting people to voluntarily comply with their news ranking system. Currently, they're trying to use, as you write in a follow-up article from January 30th, they're turning to the EU to try to get them to impose it on some of these on the major social media outlets that have signed on to an effort to clean out disinformation that might be proliferating. If they can't get voluntary compliance, they're trying to force it in through a kind of bureaucratic approach, involuntarily. So could you maybe address that aspect of it?
Sure. Well, first, it's important to point out that on my original expose on this group, I noted that, you know, their executives and have openly stated that their plan is to have NewsGuard. It's currently a voluntary browser plugin, but they have stated that their ultimate goal is to have it an involuntary part of use of the internet. Of a user of the internet's experience, you know, pretty much for everyone in the United States and eventually globally. As you mentioned, that has not been going as planned. The tech companies, which originally when NewsGuard was launched in March 2018, they had anticipated that in a few months, all the major tech companies and social media companies would have signed on. So far, the only Silicon Valley company that has signed up or partnered with them has been Microsoft. And through that partnership is how we've seen NewsGuard, you know, put on all the public library computers in the state of Hawaii, for example, and in a few other public library systems in the United States and also in a handful of universities in the United States as well. But what's happened since then, because they're not getting the response from these big tech companies that they had expected, they're looking to a piece of or a code of practice, as it's called in the European Union, that isn't really known very well in the US or Canada. It's called the Code of Practice on Disinformation. And it was passed by the European Commission of the European Union, you know, which, you know, is more bureaucracy than democracy, right? So they're basically having, right. So they're, you know, basically what the EU has done here through this code of practice is that they've basically put it upon tech companies, social media companies to do all these measures to placate them, showing that they placate the EU, showing that they're fighting so-called fake news. Otherwise, they will be regulated by the EU. They will be subject to government regulation is basically the ultimatum that the EU has given them. So basically, NewsGuard is trying to take advantage of that. Recently, they went to a European Union hosted conference about countering online disinformation. And there, one of the other CEOs of NewsGuard, Stephen Brill, there are two CEOs, he announced not only is NewsGuard going to be launching for European companies that they're going to have news guard for Italy, Germany, France, and you know, the UK, that they are also trying to talk to library systems in Europe, and they are attempting to partner with the European Broadcasting Union, which is the world's largest community of government-funded media organizations in Europe. It includes, you know, the BBC as an example, and also partner with SOMA, which calls itself a disinformation observatory that's funded by the EU and also funded by Google. So I think, you know, it's pretty significant here what NewsGuard's trying to do. They're trying to get you use this as a selling point to companies like Facebook and Twitter, because if they are able to ingratiate themselves with these groups that are already funded by the EU or funded by EU governments, you know, the case is easier. It's easier for them to convince tech companies that they can help, you know, this concern about government regulation of their services that the EU has threatened, that they can help solve that problem. NewsGuard is not profitable unless it licenses its rating system to these tech companies, right? And several of these, several recent articles on NewsGuard in the mainstream media have actually mentioned that if it fails to partner with a large social media company like Facebook or Twitter, it's likely to fail, which I think is significant. So I think because of the pushback they have gotten in the United States, they've decided to go to the EU bureaucracy specifically, to use this sort of ultimatum that the European Union has issued to basically force the hand of these tech companies in adopting NewsGuard and making it an involuntary part of social media experience, which has, you know, been the ultimate goal really from the get-go. If you look back at the interviews of the people who run this organization. It's important to point out, though, that the pushback that has been received by NewsGuard isn't just critical reporting from Mint Press or, you know, other subsequent reports done by other outlets, but it also has to do with the fact that independent tech experts had looked into the code of the plugin itself and found that it was storing and collecting information on the people who used it, which it didn't disclose originally in its privacy policy. And even though it updated its privacy policy after it was exposed, they basically issued, you know, what I would call the trust us response, saying that, you know, they promise that they don't share, store permanently the information that they collect. But, you know, given that, you know, one of their co-CEOs, who I mentioned earlier, Lewis Gordon Krowitz, he's repeatedly defended an illegal NSA surveillance. And, you know, former NSA director Michael Hayden, who oversaw that surveillance operation, is on the board of advisors. I think it's that ended up resulting in them getting pushback from another angle. They actually had the former co-founder of Mozilla, you know, of Firefox, call it a bad operation all around. So you're having pushback not just from, you know, independent media, you're having it from, you know, technologists as well. And you're also seeing it even from the Poynter Institute, which is Facebook's third-party fact-checking organization. One of the people who runs their fact-checking, the Poynter Institute's fact-checking network, came out and called NewsGuard's system reductive. So when you have Facebook's, you know, third-party fact-checking partner slamming NewsGuard and calling it a bad system, I think that helps explain why we're seeing social media companies in the U.S. unwilling to adopt it. And, you know, I would consider the fact they're going to the EU to do this really a desperate move to try and keep their business afloat, because it's been almost a year since they launched and they don't have the big partnerships they had been counting on.
I suppose that's good news for independent media, but I suppose that they're going to keep trying even if they don't succeed through the EU or some other mechanism. But you've got your two articles, and I don't know if there's a third coming out, but Whitney, thank you so much. I think that you're doing a great job here, and you're an intrepid journalist, a real inspiration. And I really encourage people to check out your articles at Mint Press News. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Whitney Webb, a staff writer for Mint Press News, and you can check out her articles on the NewsGuard story by visiting mintpressnews.com. NewsGuard is certainly not the first salvo against dissident media in the name of fighting fake news. When we return, we'll be joined by a researcher who will give us some background on the post-2016 crackdown, including the purging of hundreds of sites from Facebook and Twitter last October. Please stay tuned. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We're joined by Patrick Henningsen. He is a writer, global affairs analyst, and the founder of 21stCenturyWire.com. That's 21stCenturyWire.com. He appears as a regular guest commentator on RT News International. He's host of the Sunday Wire weekly radio show broadcast and a frequent co-host of UK Column. His work has appeared in a number of international publications, including The Guardian, Consortium News, and also on channels like Al Jazeera English, ITN Edge Media, and the U.S. syndicated radio show Coast to Coast AM. Patrick Henningsen joins us now to help navigate us through the hazards facing independent online media outlets throughout the West, and particularly the U.S., the U.K., and Canada, in the name of protection from foreign interference and Russian disinformation and so on. So, Patrick, it's great to have you back on the Global Research News Hour.
Great to be with you, Michael.
I wanted to draw your attention, first of all, to the fact that since 2016, at least, there seems to be some real concern being expressed about how their foreign actors are interfering and passing on disinformation and so on. And of course, this was, of course, in the context of the unexpected election of Donald Trump in the U.S. presidential election campaign. But I think there's a concern that on the part of the establishment that the mainstream media, the corporate media, has been unsuccessful in completely controlling the narratives that we're seeing around foreign policy, or, you know, in the U.S., NATO, and so on. And so you have independent outlets like yours, 21st Century Wire, and Global Research, and others that are getting successful in getting their contrarian viewpoints heard. And so as a result, we're seeing a lot of messaging that is countering what we're hearing, for example, about the Russian annexation of Crimea, or the white helmets in Syria, or currently the Venezuelan situation, where we've got this brutal dictator and he was not fairly elected, and so we've got to recognize the another candidate as the true interim president. So considering that, I wanted to get your thoughts about how that's happening. And we're seeing currently the current what we saw last year, the 2018 alliance partnership between Facebook and the Atlantic Council, because it seems like this since that partnership was forged, we're starting to see a lot of this information, these counter narratives being threatened and attacked and outright purged from social media. So maybe I could get you to give us a little bit of a background on the trajectory of this effort to contain and restrict inconvenient narratives in the name of fighting fake news, as it's called.
Yeah, as time goes by, it's becoming more clear. I think when the sort of the crusade against fake news was officially launched was in the immediate aftermath of Donald Trump's victory in November of 2016. Clearly, the first salvos were fired. I think the LA Times fired what was one of the first shots across the bow with an article that cited an obscure academic from Merrimack College in Massachusetts, Dr. Melissa Zimdars, who put out a fake news list of websites that her students should be wary of, sort of a fake news guide that was syndicated in the LA Times and then sort of rippled on from there. Soon after that, the Washington Post promoted a sock puppet organization called Proper Not, and devised a list of a couple of hundred alternative media websites in Europe and mostly in America and Canada, that it deemed to be in league with the Kremlin or part of some shadowy Kremlin propaganda network. So Global Research, by the way, was included in, I think, both of those lists, along with a lot of other popular titles, including, well, we were included in the Zimdars list, the initial list. So this was interesting. So that was the beginning of it. And then this kind of dovetailed with this Russian conspiracy that the Russians somehow got Donald Trump elected. And so these two things absolutely go hand in hand. You can't separate them. And so what it looks like is the establishment have tried to leverage the anger and the angst mainly from the Democratic or liberal side of the political spectrum in America to convince the public that there is this problem of fake news fueled mainly by the Russians and how it's meddled and influenced and distorted the American democracy, electoral system, etc. And in Europe, over Brexit, the same methodology is applied to sort of blame Brexit on fake news. And so there's this call across the Atlantic through all the major political establishments in Brussels, in London, and in Washington that we need to fight this problem of fake news. This is the biggest threat to Western civilization right now, is the sort of the influence, the meddling, the hacking, and so forth. And so they've kind of managed to plow quite a lot of money into this. There's a number of think tanks. It's a gravy train. It's a feeding. If you're a PhD student and you want to get a research grant, something that's related to AI and policing fake news, there's a lot of money available. There's tons of incubating projects going on right now in a number of universities in Europe, in the UK, in North America, around the world. And so this the idea that you can automate the policing of fake news. So and at the same time this is going on, the mainstream media are putting confab organizations together, like the New York Times, the Washington Post, teaming up with Silicon Valley to create organizations like the First Draft Coalition, which is advising governments, advising Silicon Valley, advising media as well and educational institutions on how to spot fake news and so forth, and what we can do about this in terms of algorithmal management of the problem. And then you have actual business model organizations like NewsGuard, which was in the news recently. Basically, they will physically fact check for fake news, and so they've got a contract with Facebook. So this is a hugely lucrative business model. So Snopes is no longer doing the fact checking for Facebook. Now NewsGuard is doing it. And who's on the board of NewsGuard? Former NSA heads, CIA heads like Michael Hayden, people from the mainstream media, from Time magazine, notorious CIA limited hangouts, mainstream organizations. So basically professional propagandists and the security state are put in charge of this supposed to solve this problem. And in the end, it's been quite obvious from a couple of things, including the exposure of the Integrity Initiative leaks in the UK, which spans to the United States. This is a network, a government-funded network of mainstream journalists, military intelligence operatives, bureaucrats, and basically the anti-Russian think tank organizations to basically seed effectively propaganda, anti-Russian propaganda, and to run smear campaigns against any pro-Russian political figures, journalists, and so forth. Run them off the road, basically. So that shows us the real problem. Russia Gate itself, I think the biggest takeaway from this is that it's allowed corporations to collude with governments to censor, to give license for a full-on aggressive program of censorship in media and pushing propaganda through mainstream media, fake news stories.
Could you comment on exactly what the motives would be for Facebook and Twitter to forge these partnerships, I mean, with the Atlantic Council and all these figures that you just mentioned? Because they are private corporations, right?
Yeah, well, the Atlantic Council is a think is supposedly a think tank, and it receives a wide range of supports, a lot of money from the Gulf Arab states. It's received support from NATO. It receives support from corporations. But you could say this is a kind of a government corporate quango, okay? And I've been a target personally of the Atlantic Council's DFR labs in a defamation campaign, which they've launched to sort of defame me and others as well that spoke up against people like John McCain, for instance, or who dared to veer from the mainstream orthodoxy. So, but what this essentially is, Michael, is outsourcing. These are all things. Information warfare used to be under the purview of the CIA. Or strictly under NATO. In fact, NATO's information warfare department was run for a while. I don't know if it still is, but out of the University of Toronto, out of the Monk School. So that's where the information warfare operation was based for NATO for a while. I don't know if it still is, but now it's been outsourced to a number of organizations, like the Atlantic Council. Is a good example, but there's many others. The Institute of Statecraft, the Integrity Initiative in the UK, we can see that. That's a network that spreads across. It overlaps with mainstream media. It overlaps with government. It overlaps with corporations. So the objective is essentially to beat back any narratives that are challenging the mainstream orthodoxy, either on the Skripal affair, on Syria, on Russia, Russiagate, Bill Browder, right across the board. So it's just trying to wrestle control of the narrative. And I think let me just say as well, the Atlantic Council and the DFR labs and the Integrity Initiative, it operates almost identically like the Israeli lobby operates. The organizational pattern, the methodology, the structure, the way they spring into action, it's the same exact system that the Israeli lobby has used very successfully in the United States for years and years, and that's a military operation. Mm-hmm. If you looked at the Al Jazeera Israeli lobby documentary that was spiked by Al Jazeera, you can watch all four episodes on Electronic Intifada, and you can see this is a planned military operation. It's an information warfare operation, and the Russia stroke fake news attack vectors are basically identical in terms of the way that they're rolled out.
To be clear, I mean, there is such a thing as fake news proliferating on the internet, right? I mean, you're just saying that basically it's just being used as a pretext for shutting down these sorts of dissenting views.
Yeah. I mean, there is fake news. But if you actually – for instance, one of the biggest fake news producers was a Democratic Party operative – named Christopher Blair, and this was actually reported by the BBC, but they did it in this kind of glowing fashion. They presented it in kind of documentary form, saying, oh, what a good thing he did, posing as a Republican, an unhinged Republican nut job, and got accounts shut down, and basically fed a lot of this fake news onto Facebook during this election cycle, and was making money hand over fist in terms of ad impressions on this. And the sort of the gravy train on that side died down. And he admitted that he was a Democrat activist. And he did this to make the right look bad. And the mainstream media just reported this like it was no big deal. But so there's a level of and he employed staff. I mean, it was a big operation. Mm-hmm. So there's a level of sophistication here that you need to unpack, that all is not what it appears to be. Now, there is fake stories, and there is a business in fake news in terms of clickbait, okay? But if you look at that in terms – there's no proof that says a fake story like Hillary was shipping arms to ISIS or all these various other – the Pope endorsed Donald Trump. Some of these were the big fake news stories that made a lot of the headlines. Now, there's no proof or no way to say that – influence people's votes, and you don't even know the amount. They go by the metrics. Oh, this has been shared and read X amount of thousands of times, more than a New York Times article. They would often quote this, but people share things for different reasons. They share them because they're ridiculous. They share them because they're funny, because they're outrageous. This is how social media works. So there's never been any scientific study to show how any of this influenced anybody's vote in the 2016 election. So the whole premise of it is ridiculous on a level. But if you look at the fake news produced by mainstream media, you look at the fake Russia stories. Paul Manafort visited Julian Assange. That was a big Guardian front page headline before Christmas. These things have the media impressions go into the billions. This dwarfs any of the little fake news stories kicking around on social media.
You mentioned this integrity initiative before. I suspect that a lot of people in Canada and even many of my listenership have never heard of it. It was an operation that was formed in late 2015, and the documents had been leaked by Anonymous. And I know you took the time to go into detail and investigate all of that documentation, albeit with a skeptical eye. And apparently, it's a kind of an intelligence secret service functioning not only in Britain, but the United States, across Europe, and even in Canada. So could you give us a little bit more background on the people behind the II?
Yeah, and the Integrity Initiative was spawned out of a cryptic named think tank called the Institute of Statecraft, which was founded in 2006 but was dormant until many years later. And the Integrity Initiative was funded to the tune of millions of pounds, not billions, millions of pounds by the UK Foreign and Commonwealth Office. And I guess this would be under the guise of information warfare and so forth. And is Cold Warriors essentially behind it? I think the person who founded it, the Integrity Initiative, is I believe Chris Donnelly, is a real Cold Warrior with Cold War pedigree. So very anti-Russian, very much in that vein. But it's organized in clusters. There's a cluster of journalists, bureaucrats, operatives in Canada, in America, and in the UK, in France, in Germany, in Croatia, Czech Republic, all the NATO countries essentially, Spain, and so forth. So the clusters will spring into action if there's an alert in their country. For instance, in Spain, there was an appointment of a defense minister, which Pedro Banias, I believe his name was, and that was spiked within hours because Integrity sprung into action and ran a defamation campaign of him across social media and pressured the government to sort of withdraw his appointment, as it were.
Yeah, that sounds like interference in the political process of another country, which is precisely what they're accusing Russia of doing.
I would say so. Yeah. I would say so. Yeah. So it's this defense minister was too friendly to Russia, and so they painted him to be a complete lunatic, basically, and took quotes out of context. Said he believed in aliens and UFOs, the usual. And so that was, and they boasted about this in their documentation, which was leaked as well. I mean, that's just scratching the surface. If you go and look at all the different five tranches of leaks from this, it's stunning what they get up to, trying to frame, trying to get Arabs to become pro-NATO, more sympathetic to NATO. They have all these objectives that they want to achieve. So, but this was always done by the intelligence services. It's just now it's coming out of the shadows, and it's being outsourced to mainstream media officially, to think tanks. And the Atlantic Council and the DFR labs are at the center hub of the Integrity Initiative, by the way. So they are central to this operation.
There's been some movement in Canada to act on this notion of foreign interference in elections. On January 30th, there was a big announcement by the Minister of Democratic Institutions, Karen Gould, sitting alongside the Minister of Defense and the Public Safety Minister, mentioning that this so-called Critical Election Incident Public Protocol Group, consisting of five bureaucrats, will alert the public if they become aware of interference during an election campaign period, or there's one coming, an election coming at the end of 2019. And It cites as an example the tainted U.S. presidential election of 2016 and the Brexit vote. And the report mentions that the panel will be made up of the clerk of the Privy Council, the federal national security and intelligence advisor, the deputy minister of justice, the deputy minister of public safety, the deputy minister of global affairs Canada. And while the deputy positions are government appointments by the minister, the minister states that these bureaucrats served under both liberal and conservative governments. So that makes them somehow nonpartisan. But this, of course, ignores the fact that there's a bipartisan consensus between both liberals and conservatives when it comes to international policy. But you know, if you're an indie journalist like yourself or myself that defy that consensus, I mean, I'm concerned that they could flag such journalists as I don't know, pro-Russian or interfering with the election if that the messaging should go viral. So, I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but and I don't expect that you've studied this program in detail. But given what you know about parallels that you've seen in the United States and the United Kingdom. I mean, Canada is a Five Eyes country and a NATO partner. What sorts of red flags does such a panel raise for you?
Well, you've actually answered the question within your question, Mike, because what they're essentially doing is lining up to attack anyone who goes off what is the sort of the streamlined narrative. And Theresa May announced the rapid response mechanism back in June. I believe this was at the G7 meeting. And what she said was, we need to all be on script. France, the UK, the US, Canada, in response to anything Russia is doing or any Russian-related incidents like Skripal or whatever, or chemical weapons attack in Duma, etc. Okay, and that was the most important thing. That the press and the governments are all on message. There's a united front. So you can see what's going on here. You said you talked about the Five Eyes, Six Eyes, Seven, Eight, Nine Eyes, coordinating the messaging, coordinating the narrative. So Global Research or 21st Century Wire or a number of other independent media outlets who aren't singing that tune are seen as basically a hole in the dam, basically. With where another narrative is getting out. And you're absolutely right that this is a bipartisan consensus. You know, they're criminalizing A1 activity. They're criminalizing free speech. They're criminalizing news, not just news, analysis and commentary, opinion, basically. So they're more afraid of the analysis and the commentary than they are of, quote, fake news. They're afraid of intelligent debate, intelligent analysis, because this resonates with a lot of people because they're not getting it on mainstream media. So that's why they're looking for intelligent news and analysis and commentary online from independent outlets. It's simple. It's supply and demand. We've got the supply and the demand is out there. The mainstream media aren't giving the supply. They're giving just basically a vapid, banal. It's the same old churn, basically. It's just the robotic Orwellian doublespeak, and people aren't liking it anymore. So this is the problem.
They restrict the parameters of the debate. So, example, with Venezuela, they're saying, well, you know, the debate is around whether or not there should be a military intervention, and not, you know, whether or not the basic assumption that Maduro has been somehow undemocratically elected to power, or the legitimacy of having Juan Guaido as the interim president. Patrick, I just wanted to kind of close with your thoughts about how the anti-war, anti-imperialist, those who dissent from these state agendas. What hope is there? What can be done to counter these influences? Because we've been reliant for a couple of decades now on the internet as an alternative that we can embrace fairly easily, in both to receive and express these dissenting concerns. So what is your suggestion as to how one can push back against these dark agendas?
That's a difficult one because the internet is now the threat to the establishment. And it, because it goes across borders, they're accusing it of influencing and meddling and et cetera in all elections. So basically our democratic processes, according to our overlords, are threatened by the free flow of information. So they're blaming in Russia for it at the moment, but soon they'll start blaming everybody. Or they're already claiming that everybody's in league with the Kremlin. And threatening with counter narratives, and somehow that's destabilizing society. This is a big problem. I don't know what the solution is to this, other than if they're coming after independent outlets, which they are doing, people need to double up their support for those independent outlets. They need to start sharing things on social media. They need to be more vocal. They need to be more active, not less active. They need to be less self-censoring of their speech, not more self-censoring. This is the only logical reaction that's going to overcome what is clearly a sort of tyranny agenda that's being implemented right now, right in front of our eyes. So make no mistake, it's happening right now. It's right in front of us. There is a massive power grab going on right now. It's happening now. It's not something that's happening in 10 years. It's happening now. And it's international. It's across the five eyes, as you said. And it's very real. And people need to activate now. And they need to sort of really put their money where their mouth is in terms of support, listenership, sharing, helping to promulgate good quality information.
Patrick Henningsen, I really appreciate your perspectives on this and your the thoroughness of your research and your diligence in providing this analysis and making it available to so many of us. Thank you so much for joining us, and all the best with your work.
You too, Mike. Keep up the great work. You got a fantastic program as well, Global Research News Hour. And we need you in the fight too. So, look forward to more broadcasts from your side too.
We've been joined by Patrick Henningsen, a writer, global affairs analyst, and founder of 21stCenturyWire.com. And he joined us from Plymouth. One final note. If the social media like Facebook and Twitter and the ubiquitous search engine Google have been compromised and are actively being used to block dissident opinion on the pretext of cleaning up fake news, then it is more urgent than ever to support CKUW and other community radio stations that air programs such as the Global Research News Hour. Radio station CKUW is located at the University of Winnipeg in downtown Winnipeg on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Nihiyawak, and the Nakota, and the heartland of the Red River Métis. To maintain the station's operating costs and uphold our commitment to supporting independent journalism that dares to question, challenge, and enlighten, we depend on listener support to make it happen. My name is Michael Welch. I've hosted and produced the Global Research News Hour since 2012, and I am appealing to you, our listeners, particularly those who have been with us a long time, to take a stand in the fight for freedom of the press, free inquiry, and free thought, and donate what you can to a worthwhile endeavor. An important part of resisting oppressive corporate policies and state violence is disrupting their narratives. And by donating to CKUW and its affiliates, you help us achieve and restore true democracy and a more humane and livable earth. On February 15th, we will be airing a live broadcast of the Global Research News Hour. This will be part of a fundraiser for the station we call FunDrive. Please consider visiting the website, fundrive.ckuw.ca, and donating $35, $70, $100, or whatever fits your budget. No strings attached to financial support from listeners like you is what keeps our program going and journalists like myself comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. That's it for this edition of the Global Research News Hour. You can send your feedback to globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. And you can stream our live show on Friday, February 15th at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Time, and 7 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time at ckuw.ca. We'll be back in 2 weeks with regular programming. Thank you so much for joining us.